Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Gigabit Nation, Broadband Talk Radio. I'm your host, Craig Settles, and I'd like to welcome everyone in the audience today, and thank you for taking time to be with us as we help public, private, and nonprofit organizations and tackle important broadband issues, getting this technology everywhere that it needs to be. Today is day two at the Fiber to the Home conference here in Dallas. It's been a very interesting couple of days of interesting sessions, lots of interesting vendors, just a lot of stuff going on in this whole broadband arena. For those of you who've listened to my show quite a bit, know that I spend a fair amount of time talking about broadband and economic development. In fact, that's how we kicked off the show yesterday. Today, we're going to talk about economic development and probably give you some information that you might not have known about in this broadband arena. Chattanooga is very well known for its gigabit network. But I think what people, or a lot of people, don't know is that the network actually started out not with the mission of delivering a gigabit to people's homes. It started out as an exercise in economic development, where the idea being that the utility, EPB, would upgrade its smart grid system as a way to better manage their electricity services, and as a result, there would be a number of significant economic benefits, and probably a lot more than folks realize. Today, I am very happy to have as our guest, Katie Espeset, who is the Vice President of EPB Fiber Optics. And we're going to talk about those early days of fiber in Chattanooga, but more importantly, we're going to really focus on the economic impact that it's had and how other communities can replicate some of these successes. Katie, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Craig. Appreciate you inviting us to join you. Thank you.
And so let's get into the history. So once upon a time, there was this idea to bring fiber to Chattanooga. So I'm going to let you take it because obviously this is your story and I should not steal your thunder.
I'll back up. I don't know if there's any thunder to steal, but basically EPB is a municipally owned electric power distributor. And we've been in business for about 70 years. And core to our business, our original mission, was really to become an economic development tool for the community by electrifying the valley. That mission remains the same today for us. It's economic development and quality of life. And so providing more reliable electric power just syncs with that mission perfectly. So about 10 years ago, we started looking at ways to modernize our grid. We started looking at studies that were being done by independent organizations. One was the Electric Power Research Institute. TVA had a study. UC Berkeley published a study. And pretty much the results were, or the outlook was pretty similar. Electric outages or power outages cost the country as a whole about $80 billion a year. And those losses are non-revenue. It's actually in lost productivity, lost wages, manufacturing locations that have to shut down, and things like that. If you take those same statistics and you compare those to an area the size of Chattanooga, you'll come to the conclusion that power outages to a community the size or similar to Chattanooga's about cost the community about $100 million a year. I go back to our mission for economic development. Well, what do companies look for when they are either going to expand or to locate a new facility? It's access to reliable power, and in modern day, it's access to these what we call next generation broadband services. So we started going down this path of fiber by saying, how do we modernize our electric system and how do we reduce the duration of power outages? You know, the electric power grid in the country today is pretty much the same all over, and it's not a reflection. It doesn't mean we're behind. But if you bought a car, let's say in 1930, and you maintained it, you took perfectly good care of it, it'd probably still run today. And that's sort of the way the electric power grid is. But if you look at a car today and you look at the console and you've got all sorts of gauges that tell you when you need to add air to your tires or change your oil and that sort of thing. It's all about a communication system. So we took that same philosophy and applied it to our electric grid, and that's really what drove us to the fiber network, because you've got to have the power, that basically limitless power of fiber, in order to talk to that many devices all around your system.
Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding of smart grid before I started talking to folks in Chattanooga really was about smart meter reading. And in 1999, when I was working for a company that was the precursor to municipal Wi-Fi, one of the divisions of that company sold technology that would allow a truck to ride through communities, and it would read people's meters and take all that data and come back to the office and drop it into a system. And everybody thought, oh, gee, that's pretty neat. But what has been, you know, short, the condensed history of, you know, how we've gotten from that to where smart grid is now? And I bring this question up because I remember when I first started talking about Chattanooga, the first thing someone said was, well, if all you're doing is meter reading and you're just pulling data from people's meters, why do you need a fiber network for that?
You probably don't need a fiber network if that's all you're going to do with it. It's okay. Just read meters. We certainly do use our fiber network to read meters, and we estimate that'll save us between $2 and $3 million a year operationally by mm-hmm. using the fiber optic network to read meters. But that is really just the tip of the iceberg. While we will, by the end of this year, have 170,000 smart meters all across our system, that's only a small part. We're pulling back data from those meters in 15-minute increments. We're working with Bell Labs to create a huge smart grid management system to bring back all that intelligence and ultimately give our customers better ways to control their energy.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's just a small part of it. More importantly, our largest savings to the community come where we can actually cut the duration of power outages. When we first started making projections about the impact our smart grid network would have on the community, we estimated it would save about 40% or cut the duration of an outage by 40%. If you apply that to the $100 billion, that gives you $40 million a year in lost productivity, mm-hmm. lost wages to the community. And while our smart grid is not complete, it's almost complete, it'll be complete by the end of this year, we have installed about 1,200 SNC smart interrupter switches
mm-hmm.
that constantly remain in touch with us, and we're able to pinpoint outages and reroute power in the event of any sort of weather or any sort of outage situation. It's already working. We had a gust storm that blew through Chattanooga on July 5th, we lost power to over 80,000 customers. 42,000 of those customers didn't even realize they had an outage. For less than 2 to 5 seconds, over half of those folks' power was restored.
Mm-hmm.
So what we tell our folks, and it's very true, when the lights flicker, that means the smart grid is working.
Okay.
So if you can reduce power outages or reduce the duration by half, you've returned $50 million of savings to the community. A couple other things it does for you, I mentioned, it does give us some operational efficiencies in reading meters. You know, people also steal power. I had no earthly idea until I went to work for an electric power district. They steal it. They do all sorts of things.
Wow.
To steal power. And, you know, all of us pay for that.
Right, right.
As an electric distributor, we still have to pay for that power. So that impacts all of us. And those numbers have been estimated anywhere from $5 to $10 million mm-hmm. impact on us. Well, with the smart grid, with those literally thousands of points of communication on the network, we know when a meter has been tampered with,
mm-hmm.
and we can stop the theft. So right away, you're looking at $5,000 to $10,000 in real savings to the utility, which translates to real savings to our customers.
Mm-hmm. So in essence, the impact here is on multiple layers. There is savings to EPB as a utility, but as a public utility, then this circulates, in essence, back to the public in the sense that it's saving money, and it ultimately saves the public money. But then there's also the usage that is increased by both businesses and residential, because the power is not down, or if it is down, it's not down as much.
That's correct. Uh-huh.
And so subsequently you have... Mm-hmm. Now, do people realize... I mean, you've talked to a lot of folks, but do people in other communities realize that or how much this impact is on businesses? Because right, because somebody might look at it and say, well, you know, a couple of minutes in my home or even a day, I mean, that's significant if I'm
sure.
a person, but there, I think there's a business impact that goes way beyond
There is a huge business impact, and you're right. I suspect that it's certainly not widely known among residential customers that there is this sort of cost to businesses. If you look at independent sources like Site Selector magazine and those who actually go out and rank communities, and you look at what factors play into when they recommend a site, you'll see access to first reliable power, and then secondly, or certainly near on that list, is access to these second generation large bandwidth broadband services as being very high on the list before these services will recommend that a company locate or even expand there.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that people who are running the businesses and certainly people who are making recommendations recognize the worth of access to good power.
Mm-hmm. So in a business environment, let's start maybe a little tick list of all the ways in which improved energy management has an economic impact. So there's one, if I'm out for a day, that's a huge impact, right, on the business community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you have a sense of it to that level, but...
Well, if you picture just a manufacturing plant
mm-hmm.
who, for some reason, doesn't necessarily know that their power is out for the weekend, they come in on a Monday morning and the power is out, and, you know, there's always startup time
mm-hmm.
on the large machinery. So they're already behind maybe a full shift
okay.
by the time they come in. If, A, they didn't know, or, B, we didn't know
mm-hmm.
prior to the smart grid. So there's all sorts of ways that you probably wouldn't just think of off the top of your head that you're not just talking about losing 15 minutes worth of work. You may be losing an entire shift, an entire day, and that ties directly back to monetary value and product.
Mm-hmm. And then the volume, the dollar volume, is incrementally greater as the size of the community is greater.
It is. The $100 million that I referenced was really for a community the size of Chattanooga. And just to kind of put that in perspective, Chattanooga's home to about 500,000.
Mm-hmm.
EPB is the electric power distributor. Actually, we serve about 170,000 homes and businesses
mm-hmm.
in our area. So that's how we brought the $80 billion down to a community our size
okay.
based on those numbers.
Then, there's that one element. Then you have lost productivity. But then also, if you are able to manage the electricity use, and you can manage it down to the customer level, isn't there also opportunities to make the business customer's use of electricity more effective that will also have an impact on that business?
Certainly. There are some businesses who are on our time of use rates. We will eventually be rolling time of use rates out to our residential customers as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we pay our power bill based on our peak usage. So it's good for all of us if we can take those peaks, basically, and shave them and spread our usage out where we don't have the huge spikes in the large valleys of when electricity is not being used. It saves us all money. The cost of power is going up, and we can't promise that this will bring the price of power down, but it will help us all use it more efficiently and, in the long run, hold down the cost of energy for our community.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there other aspects of this utility management that has then an impact on the business community, either in terms of allowing them to operate more efficiently or save additional money?
We have a large commercial client who actually sits very near one of those 1,200 IntelliRupture switches
mm-hmm.
that I mentioned earlier, and they called because they had some machinery that was actually tripping and going offline, which was translating into downtime for their manufacturing facility.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, what we would have had to have done was actually get the power back on, send our folks to that location, basically wait for the same event to occur again, and perhaps make a diagnostic discovery at that time and be able to prevent it in the future. But again, the customer would have been out of power. They would have lost productivity. They wouldn't have been happy, and it would not have been a good situation for any of us.
Mm-hmm.
But using the pole top telemetry from those interrupter switches, we were able to go back and query what had happened in the past, and were able to see that there was actually a fault that occurred on the line. It had tripped something, and so we were able to go back to the customer and say, if you'll change your settings on your equipment, you can keep this from happening
mm-hmm.
going forward. It was a very valuable lesson for us that we need to use that data that we're pulling back for the smart grid to help our customers.
Mm-hmm. And is there, and we talked operationally, are there new opportunities that open up if you are, you know, if you look at the business community as a whole, are there new opportunities that open up as a result of better energy management?
Well, certainly access to better management tools, access to more information helps you control your usage better. And the advantage that the smart grid has given Chattanooga is that this fiber optic network, all this information is available anywhere in our 600-square-mile area.
Mm-hmm.
So while if you're looking to locate a business, it doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter if you're in the far rural area of our service area or if you're sitting right downtown. You have access to the same tools that any large business has had access to in the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about business attraction? Because I don't know if it was someone I talked to at EPB or maybe somewhere in another community, but do you use or does the chamber use this reliability of the grid as a tool to bring businesses in?
Yes, absolutely. We have a very active, very productive chamber organization, and we can point to some large successes in the community that actually built facilities in the community, not entirely because of smart grid, not entirely because of our high-speed services, but certainly played a factor in their decision. Volkswagen manufacturing
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is probably the most prominent of those. We also have a large distribution site for Amazon. There have been countless number of small businesses. We have a great entrepreneurial spirit in Chattanooga. And again, because we're putting the tools that very large businesses used to have access to in the hands of everyone, we're seeing a big uptick in our small business
mm-hmm.
growth, creation and growth. When we were doing the business plan, we worked with a professor at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga who partnered with two other colleagues from other universities, and we asked them to give us a forecast, make a projection of what impact a network like this would have on Chattanooga. And their findings were that over a 10-year period, we could look for about 3,700 new jobs
mm-hmm.
and about $1.2 billion in capital investment over a 10-year period to come to the community as a result of building something like this. Well, I'm happy to say we had our third anniversary on September the 15th. The community can actually point to about 4,800 new jobs.
Mm-hmm.
$1.3 million in capital investment that has come to the community in part because of this access to more reliable power in these broadband services.
And so the chain of that goes that you have the network, you ensure greater reliability, you use that as a leveraging tool to get people to come on to come to Chattanooga,
mm-hmm.
and those people coming to Chattanooga citing this as one of the reasons why they've come to town, then gets translated out to the 4,800
new jobs. Mm-hmm.
And what was the dollar?
$1.3 billion in new capital investment.
That's billion, that's with a B.
That's a
B. Okay. So it's been, because one of the issues with economic development and broadband has been the issue of measuring, quantifying, projecting. Or I probably want to put the projecting part first, but in essence, people feel like, well, we can't really quantify this. And when opponents, you know, talk against broadband or who needs, you know, the fiber network, it becomes an issue of qualitative more so than quantitative. But how has EPB addressed the issue of trying to quantify things, both on the front end and the back end. I know you relied a lot on the Berkeley study, but I think what there were some other steps that you that your group took to kind of get a clearer picture on what the potential impact would be.
We did. We actually were in a planning process for almost 5 years. We spent a lot of time talking to what we thought would be our customers. What were you looking for in products? What did you buy? What did you think was missing in the community? Our CEO sat down with a number of CEOs in the community and had one-on-one conversations. We met with neighborhood association groups, large groups. We had meetings on cul-de-sacs. And our message was consistent. Is this something you want us to do? Do you see a need for it, and do you want us to go forward? Let us know one way. Let our board of directors know. Let our city council know. And overall, the feedback was absolutely a resounding yes.
Mm-hmm.
Go forward. We also had conducted some independent studies of our own performance. We looked at some of our own numbers and felt very comfortable that we matched up with the projections of the Berkeley study and others. The study I referenced before from the gentleman at University of Tennessee
mm-hmm.
actually was tied to an in-plan model, which is not solely used to just project impact from a fiber optic network. It actually is a well-known tool to project project impact of large capital-intensive projects like an airport
mm-hmm.
or an NFL franchise or something like that. So it wasn't a study methodology that was invented for this deployment or for anything like this.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved directly with the original planning group?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I was fortunate enough to do that.
All right. No, fess up to that. That's good stuff. So my question is, was there a visionary among your group that sort of saw this bigger picture, or did the pieces kind of come together over time? You know, first there was, well, we could save a bunch of money, then the businesses could save money, and, you know, was it linear, or did someone kind of at the beginning see that big picture potential?
You know, I think EPB is extremely fortunate to work for a public power, municipally owned utility. You really have to understand the mission, and you have to buy into the mission.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that you're there really to serve the community. And if you go back to our mission, it kind of makes it easy to make these decisions. If you bounce everything you do or every decision you make over, is it compatible with your mission? Does it further what you were created to do? It makes decision-making fairly easy. So we do have a great leadership team. And if he probably wouldn't want me to say this, but if I had to say there was one visionary, certainly our CEO, Harold DePriest,
mm-hmm.
Really has been an extremely strong influence behind this project from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He had the vision to create a CLEC organization as part of EPB, which was originally EPB Telecom. We went into the ISP business in 2004, and it really grew. As that business became profitable, we saw the potential. We knew that we had the folks. We had hired the right people to actually operationalize it. And he also had the vision to see that you can manage this fiber optic network, whether it's for electric or for its communication, with the same people that you have running your electric system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the people that are risking their lives every day
mm-hmm.
To bring you electric power. They can certainly handle the communication piece of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been fortunate to have several visionaries.
Okay, great. And over time, this has panned out. I'm curious, when EPB started moving into the broadband space, particularly for selling the services, were people aware of the value to smart grid? Were they aware of the value of the network as an asset before they even got, you know, started hearing about, oh, we could get faster broadband?
You know, I wish that that they had seen that. You know, interestingly enough, the first questions we got were, how many channels do you have? How many are going to be HD?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing, which is great, which is fine. We're in that business too. But over time, Chattanooga has seen some extremely violent weather, just like other areas of the country. And I think now, after the last probably 18 months, you know, we had 9 tornadoes hit us one day in April. We've had some tremendous storms. I think now with those type of weather events, people are beginning to see the value of the smart grid.
Mm-hmm.
We're happy that they see value in any of our services.
So let's project a little bit to other communities. Would it make sense in the early days of the planning? This is going to be a two-part question.
Okay.
The first part is, would it make sense to plan, say, more for the smart grid side than the broadband side? In other words, let the smart grid be the driver, in essence, as opposed to a lot of communities want to build a broadband network. Now, again, not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's
sure.
It's a question of, now that we have hindsight behind us, you know, would we recommend that? And then the second part of that would be, well, when we start to promote the broadband service, does it, you know, make sense to market that other capability as well, the smart grid capability?
Well, certainly in the case of EPB as an electric power distributor, it made much more sense for us to start with the smart grid.
Mm-hmm.
That is our core business. We also knew that we needed the fiber infrastructure to bring back all those literally billions of pieces of information back. So it was a given that we needed the fiber infrastructure. We also felt like Chattanooga at the time was pretty underserved.
Mm-hmm.
From a standpoint of communications. You know, Chattanooga was not a huge city. We're growing. We're vibrant. Our downtown's been completely revitalized. We're definitely moving in the right direction. But we really needed both in the case of Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
We needed to turn the town from where it had been before. You know, we started as the Dynamo of Dixie at the beginning of the century. You know, Walter Cronkite opened the CBS Nightly News back in 1969 by calling us the country's dirtiest little city. I mean, that had to be our low point, you know.
Right.
So we actually, for Chattanooga, needed both. But I think the model is applicable for many communities
mm-hmm.
across the country.
Because I think that, you know, as I, being a marketing person, I realize that there are a number of ways that you can promote something, that you can market something. And while there is value in being focused, I think that if you look at the bigger picture of marketing, you know, that you want to create a truly supportive environment, that it may make sense for other communities to emphasize the smart grid aspect of it first. For one thing, it takes away the triviality argument, what I call the triviality mm-hmm. argument, which is, why are we spending tax dollars to build broadband? Why are we having all this angst and agony because America doesn't have fast broadband and so forth? And so it lets people who are critical, not even just of a municipality owning it, but it is critical of this whole idea that we need to build better broadband regardless of who does it.
Right.
Right. I think then you need to, if you're going to be successful in the long run, you have to counter that kind of negativity. And the best way to do it is to say, hey, you know, we actually are more than just fast
mm-hmm.
internet. We're smart grid. We're economic development. In other words, you know, pointing out those other.
That's a tremendous way to go about making people aware of your business. I will say, EPB's deployment did not include any tax dollars whatsoever. So that makes
set
us apart a little bit in that example. But you know, electricity is tough to market. I mean, people, you just take it for granted unless you go in a room and flip the switch and it doesn't come on. You
right.
don't really think about it that
you
much.
Think about it when you're missing it.
You're right. You're exactly right, which is not of the best all situations. So while I agree with you that is absolutely, there is so much more value in what the smart grid, more reliable power, ways to hold down your usage or to hold down the cost to you, to give you that control are universally much more important reasons. Frankly, as a consumer, many folks are concerned about what kind of speed do I have on my internet, how many channels do I have,
mm-hmm.
how fast is it, how many video on demand, which is all good too. All those things have a place. That's just usually more, that usually sparks more interest initially, but it's not the whole picture by any means.
Right. Because from a financial standpoint, I mean, as in the financial well-being of the entity that's selling the broadband,
mm-hmm.
these other things seem to be of stronger interest. In other words, the value to me of smart grid as a business asset, if I'm a utility, has high value. If I look at my customer base, broadband, high-speed broadband actually has, you know, more value that people are willing to spend more money for as a business user more so than a consumer
user. It's really, in the case of our deployment, it's a win-win for the entire community,
mm-hmm.
because you're exactly right. The benefits of the smart grid pay for the system.
Right.
If we never sold the broadband service, it would pay for the system,
mm-hmm.
and benefits to the community and operational savings to the utility. But then on top of that, you add revenue generated by the sale of these broadband services, and you really win both ways.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we became profitable. The fiber optics grew as a standalone division, became profitable. And I'll also tell you that we put $17 million of revenue into the electric side of our business in allocation and in fees and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That $17 million that the electric utility would not have gotten in cash, and we estimate that we've been able to hold rates down by about 5% over where they would have been without that $17 million. So whether you're a customer of ours, of our broadband services or not, you still have access to better power,
mm-hmm.
and then you also have access to a lower power,
mm-hmm.
because of the broadband services.
So let's talk about the pivot point from when you are looking at the fiber investment and the fiber usage as a smart grid play, as it were, and now we're saying, okay, well, we want to now sell broadband services. What are the changes that have to happen to the utility company in order to make that pivot?
Well, there really has to be a broad culture change. And EPB had been about the business of changing the culture for about 10 years before we ever got into the business. You know, selling electricity is somewhat a monopoly, at least it is in our area, but you really, we all understand that you cannot act like a monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
People will have choices, and that's just not really core to our mission. So you've got the culture change going on. Prior to going into the broadband business, we didn't go inside of people's homes. I mean, basically, if we came to fix something or to work on your meter or on your drop or something like that, we stayed outside of your house. Even as a CLEC, or Competitive Local Exchange Company, we brought our communication services to a DMARC inside your business. We didn't go inside your business. We
mm-hmm.
didn't wire the phones on your desk or anything. So we really had to go about the business of training our entire company. Now you're inside people's homes. Now you're inside people's business. It really is about giving that personalized, great customer service. EPB has a great reputation for good customer service. We just needed to kick it up a notch, not necessarily get any better, but also extend that same good service when we're inside folks' homes.
Okay. So it's a... it's a thinking shift. Do you have to change the operational structure very much? Do you have to add different people? Are there changes that way?
You know, we did add a few people with specialized knowledge. Again, we were a CLEC before, so we had some folks with good telephony background. We were an ISP, so we had a few people that were core to the business that understood that. But by and large, over the last 3 years, pretty much our operations are integrated across the board.
Mm-hmm.
I think at our highest peak, we probably had about 30 people who were specialized only in the communication products. That's pretty much gone away. We're a very flat, non-siloed organization.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do it on electric, you need to be able to do it on communications or vice versa. It's just a lot more efficient and makes good sense.
Mm-hmm. So from a marketing perspective, do you add a certain level of marketing expense once you add on the internet business? And are there other sort of, I don't know, additional costs? I mean, you talked about basically there isn't a lot of change per se, but now all of a sudden, don't you end up having to market more? Because when you had the smart grid, there really wasn't a need to market it so much. It was there.
Well, you know, it changes your focus a little bit. We've always tried to be very involved in the community. We sponsor events. We have public service announcements. We've always been about educating our folks. Don't go near drop lines. Mm-hmm. Don't do things like that. And you know, we have a little over 400 employees, and they all live in Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
So we're out in the community. We're well known. Our brand has a good perception in the community. We had to change that a little bit because now you're in a competitive head-to-head business.
Aha, yes,
now you're going against the big guys.
Right, right.
So you need to be able to talk about your products knowing that you're the last one into the game.
Mm-hmm.
So it does change the way you talk about things a little bit.
Right. Now, yesterday we had one of the managers, one of the senior managers from Lafayette, and to talk about their project. Now, one of the points that came out was you have an advantage being the hometown team. So there's a certain level of civic pride and community ownership that comes into play. But, you know, I asked the question, you know, can you win just by being the hometown team, or do you have to have something more than that going for you?
Yeah, I agree that being the hometown team helps, and certainly we being local is a big advantage, but it absolutely is not the only thing you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our philosophy from entering the market was to deliver a superior product,
mm-hmm,
and continue to add value all along the way. So local is great, and I think it's one of the reasons people so enthusiastically embrace our products, but you got to earn that every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Your products have to be better. Your products have to be cost competitive. Every time the technician's in your home or the phone rings, you have to be better,
mm-hmm,
than your competition.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would make the assumption that any community that owns its own utility, the utility is the logical choice to pursue broadband, starting with the smart grid enhancement as maybe the cost justifier. But they have the relationships, they have the customer service apparatus, they have the deployment. I mean, you know, you're used to rolling trucks, mm-hmm, to deal, mm-hmm, with issues and so forth. Do you think public utilities have, you know, an inherent advantage that works to the community's favor? You know, if I were a community saying, okay, we can, you know, we can start a nonprofit organization, we can have the city, you know, directly, the municipal government directly own it. I mean, you have these choices. Does it make sense to say, well, maybe you should just default to the public utility?
Well, I think that in many cases, the public utility is a great choice. There are also examples of public-private partnerships. There are different ways you can go about doing this. You know, as a utility, as a public utility, we build infrastructure. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So building this broadband network was a natural evolution for us. We have the poles. We have the right-of-way. We have the equipment. We have the expertise. We manage these large capital projects day in, day out. So for us, it made sense. And I think in many, many communities in the country, it would make sense. I think there are probably other options, too. And I think it really depends on what resources you have in your community.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain mindset that needs to be in place either on the part of the utility or the part of the community in order for this kind of an idea to take?
Well, first you have to do, I think, for the right reasons. You need to do, I would hope that the utility would do it for the benefit of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more than likely core to their mission. And then the community has to want you to do it. I mean, that's the other piece of this. You have to earn their respect. They have to have the confidence that you are going to spend the money wisely as an investment and that you're going to give them products that have more value. than what they could currently get in the market. So it's kind of little bits and pieces of all of that.
Mm-hmm. So it all kind of can make a lot of can make a lot of sense. Why is it that it seems there is less interest among private utilities than public utilities to get into the space? Now, with the public utility, we will assume, at least for the moment, that people want to be in, you know, the public utility wants to be in because it's a community effort and they are part of the community. But it seems like there's a reluctance on the private utility side. Has anyone explored or surveyed or tried to figure out exactly why that is?
You know, I'm not aware of that. I would just probably look at it as saying that our customers or our ratepayers are our stockholders.
Right.
And we're actually building and creating things for our stockholders. So if your stockholders are different or driven by different desires, if they're looking for return on investment, there's nothing wrong with that either.
Mm-hmm.
It's just different than what public power is driven by.
So it's a business philosophy, and it may be that the private utility doesn't see this as being a worthwhile adventure.
I can just look at it from the way we went at it,
mm-hmm.
and that is not fact based at all.
Okay. So one of these days, I think that somebody should step up and do that kind of research, you know, because I look at it like I had a conversation here earlier with a person who is on who's with a telecom co-op, and we were discussing the fact that, well, you know, as a telecom co-op, going into the broadband business was like a logical extension.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sort of look at a public utility and say, well, you know, given all the apparatus, all the things that you described that EPB has as an advantage, if I were a private utility, I would look at it the same way as, well, this is just an extension of what we do. But that's probably a discussion for other minds to kind of come at.
Well, it certainly seems logical, though.
Absolutely. It certainly does that.
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about the network and economic development. And that's kind of, you know, my running theme for this week, because I'm about to release my survey report on having interviewed economic development professionals to gauge, you know, how they see broadband impacting economic development. From Chattanooga's perspective, what has a gig done for the economic outlook for the city?
Well, I think the city's revitalized, just like all of our customers have access to the smart grid infrastructure. They all also have access to what we call these next generation communication services.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we announced the ubiquitous or universal availability of a gig 2 years ago, in fact, at this conference, at the Fiber to the Home conference.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, we've had tremendous economic growth. The unemployment rate in Chattanooga has been consistently below that at a national level. Chattanooga, the population in Chattanooga is growing for the first time in many, many years. All of these are very positive indicators of a great and vibrant growing city. You know, access to gigabit, access to these private line type services that we offer, a VLAN service or virtual local area network, are services that have been traditionally available to large companies for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But you had to spend a lot of money to get it, and you also had to be in an area where those services were available. Well, the difference in Chattanooga is even the very small customers have access to that type of bandwidth, to that same type of private type networks that only big customers used to. So it really does put tools in the hands of small businesses that were previously only available to those folks who could and were willing to spend a lot of money to get those.
Mm-hmm. So in the small business side, we're basically talking about making the small business more competitive?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Giving them the tools to, you know, we heard in the morning session about knocking down borders
mm-hmm.
and really making businesses borderless, and access to these type of internet speeds and low latency performance is really what knocks down those borders.
Mm-hmm. And we are seeing a number of areas where broadband is making a difference. and maybe, you know, the Chattanooga is in a good position to comment on this. One of my assumptions, one of the things that my survey actually asked the question about is, can you use this technology to revitalize an area? Like in where I live in Oakland, we have a number of areas where there are, you know, many blocks of abandoned warehouses and abandoned buildings, but the potential for revitalizing, in other words, there's space there, it's cheap land, it's cheap rent, right? You know, and the question is, would broadband be that missing ingredient that would allow the city to revitalize that area? You know, you guys have gone through a lot of revitalization since the Walter Cronkite days. Do you see broadband as having that ability to take and turn around blighted areas?
Yes, without a doubt. And again, because the services are universally available, it doesn't matter. In the blighted areas, in the rural areas, you still have access to those type of tools. We can point to, we talk about the Volkswagens and we talk about the Amazon, which are great wins for the community, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other businesses that have moved to Chattanooga, who have relocated to Chattanooga, and whose site is part of the reason for coming. HomeServe, Claris Networks, who's moving most of their operations to Chattanooga from Knoxville, and we're delighted with that. But it's access to this type of bandwidth in cost-effective doses,
mm-hmm,
that really is what's kind of pushing Chattanooga out in front.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, you know, steps to move forward. We're going to shift you to peer counseling mode. All right, you've got folks on the line, folks on the air that are saying, well, maybe we should try to get our public utility engaged. Maybe we should look at revamping our smart grid as the first step or the first reason for having a fiber network. What would you tell them? What are like the first, I don't know, 3-4 steps?
You probably need to talk to your public utility.
Okay.
You need to talk to your city council,
mm-hmm,
or your governing, your elected officials in your area, and really demand that you have these type of tools.
Mm-hmm.
I think the average bandwidth speed in the United States is 5 megs. And I'll tell you,
on a good day,
we celebrate our third birthday, and on 2 weeks ago we upped our lowest speed tier to 50 megs up and down.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because we felt like the community could use it and would use it. So I think you need to talk to your elected officials, you need to talk to your public utility, and you need to demand that you should have access to these type of tools.
Mm-hmm.
You need it for your future. Your city needs it for their future, and you need it for your own personal future.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible, if I were in planning mode, you know, I'm Community X, want to have broadband, you know, I'm thinking, well, you know, we have a public utility. If from a financial planning perspective, if I plan to put a fiber network in some of my more rural areas as well as my more urban areas, because you guys cover both, and I justified that building of the infrastructure based on the smart grid improvements and so forth, have I now made it made the case for bringing the internet very minor? In other words, if I were to look at 600 square miles and said, okay, we're going to build a broadband network, right? Someone would probably say that's going to be, you know, X millions of dollars because you have all this land to cover, you know, and on top of that, the expense of building it in some of my more rural areas, I only have, you know, a few homes per square mile, so the revenue potential is small. So I got a big dollar investment because I got a big land area. Mm-hmm. I've got mixed, you know, subscriber revenue potential, right?
High density and low density.
Exactly, exactly, right? So if I plan it from the broadband perspective, that's what I'm looking at. But if I go and let's say, well, let's build a 600-mile fiber enhancement of the smart grid, in which case I've got to bring electricity to the furthest most, mm-hmm, you know, the low density as well as the high density, Do the economics almost work out differently as a financial plan?
Well, if you look at the financial plan separately, it may very well.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Chattanooga, as you mentioned, had a good mixture of high density miles as well as some rural miles. But overall, it worked out for both sides for EPB.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to look at the situation as a whole. You may have to look at your smart grid deployment and your broadband deployment and come to some sort of middle of the road, but it will be, it very well can be profitable
mm-hmm.
when you consider both of them together.
Okay. Now, when you guys were in the early planning stage, had people thought about providing services, or did the idea of providing services come somewhere after the smart grid was jamming?
Well, we were working on the smart grid, but we also ran a business-to-business CLEC
mm-hmm.
already.
Okay.
So we served about 2,000 of our business customers already with a much smaller fiber network. We served internet and phone,
mm-hmm.
just business.
Okay. Okay.
It was not the GPON technology. It was not the same network, but very robust.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to what was available in the area. So we did have some experience, and we knew that we wanted to take that technology, take it further, give those same tools that the big customers had that we had built to in Chattanooga, and deploy that all across our service area.
Mm-hmm. So it was a so you had a running start.
We had a running start in that piece of the business.
Okay. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. So, okay, so now... Now, if you didn't have that, do you still see the bridge being able to be crossed? In other words, a company with a public utility could still cross that bridge, you know, starting with a maybe the better question to be asked is, if someone is starting from scratch, should they plan for both from the outset?
I think it's a win-win.
Okay.
From our standpoint, to plan for both.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you that if you're an electric utility, you have already the brain power
mm-hmm.
and the manpower to make this work.
Okay.
You may have to hire some experts and seed them in the communication industry in your organization, but that's only for a short time.
Okay.
That knowledge will spread.
Okay.
So the businesses cross over much more than I would have ever thought.
Mm-hmm. If I look at the smart grid side of the business first, what are some of the biggest challenges that you had to overcome?
You know, challenges from the smart grid perspective, it probably was just the speed of the build of the network.
Okay.
It wasn't really a problem for us, but we literally built it in less than 3 years, and that's about 6,500 miles of fiber network that went up in about a three-year period.
Wow.
So while that wasn't a challenge, that was certainly our primary focus
mm-hmm.
for about 36 months.
Okay. And then moving over to the internet side, what were some of the challenges, minor or not, in that side of the business?
I think if we had it to do over again, we would probably have launched with a much more aggressive internet product. When we entered the business in 2009, we launched with a 15 meg offer.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the incumbents that was really the top level of their services. So we said, okay, our bottom level will be their top.
Okay.
Well, that just kind of started in a we're faster, you're faster, back and forth, kind
mm-hmm.
of gradually ratcheting up the speeds over time. And that's really what led to us in 2010 just saying, gloves are off, go the full gig, it's available.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, in 2010, we doubled our speeds. So our lowest speed was 30,
mm-hmm.
and then I mentioned a couple of weeks ago we raised that lower speed to 50. If we had to do over again, we probably would just have hit the market running a little bit faster with the larger internet.
Just
product.
Play the cards from the outset
just
and move.
Just go with it. That's what you do best with this fiber network.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody can argue with you over your capabilities or latency on these networks. You might as well go with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about the economic benefit, you know,
mm-hmm.
the number of jobs and the number of dollars. Who was the, person by name, but who did the metrics assessment? In other words, to say, okay, we've achieved this.
I mentioned earlier we have a terrific, very active chamber, organization,
mm-hmm.
Chamber of Commerce in Chattanooga. They do a great job of bringing in prospects and taking them through the process. We rely on their metrics.
Okay.
I mean, we rely on the numbers that they publish
mm-hmm.
to calculate the impact to Chattanooga.
Okay. So they're doing also, I assume, the impact on businesses and okay, because that would be. By the way, does Chattanooga have a formal economic development agency?
There is a group at the chamber. There is an economic development association as part of the state, a regional economic
okay.
development. There's actually a cabinet post of economic development at the state level.
Okay, okay. But not one for the...
There is one that encompasses Chattanooga. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, because one of the things I found interesting, about a month ago, was city planners. I think in my mind, over the years, I've always assumed that city planner, regional planner, they're just a division of the economic development agency or department or whatever a city might have. Come to find out, no, they are a separate entity. Also came to find out that not always do the city planners interact with the economic development folks when one or the other decides that having broadband is a good thing. And so we had a whole show about, you know, how do we, like, make people more aware of city planning and so forth? Do you have a general, I don't know, assessment of how people should, communities should engage both of those entities?
You know, Chattanooga is a good model for building support from a grassroots level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about the Walter Cronkite situation, which really kind of rallied the community prior to even creation of the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
How do you clean up the air?
Right.
And then our Mayor Bob Corker started actually Chattanooga Vision 2000, which what do you want your community to become?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a beautiful aquarium that anchors the southern end of the northern end of our downtown. And all of that really came out of a visioning process that the community came together. There were public meetings
mm-hmm.
where they literally drew on sheets of paper what you wanted on the riverfront, what was going to take place. Different committees were formed, and Chattanooga really did it from a grassroots level up.
Mm-hmm. So that, in some respects, is different, I assume, than how other cities approach the planning function.
You know, I think we stole that idea for some good cities, but that's okay too. It
right,
worked.
Right.
It worked. So there is a great sense of civic pride in Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we hosted the Gig Tank
right,
a couple
right,
weeks
right.
ago.
That was a fun time.
That was fun. It was exciting. You know, it started out with a $50,000 prize
mm-hmm.
by some young venture capitalists. It
right.
grew into $300,000 with some great corporate sponsors.
Wow.
Chattanooga had 36 brilliant entrepreneurs and students who
mm-hmm.
spent the summer with us, all trying to solve the problem, what do you do with the gig?
Right.
And if you could have seen, and I know you did, Craig, the room that was packed.
Right.
Presentation
there were like 500 people. You had an
yeah,
overflow room. Too,
we did.
Right?
It was great. And that kind of enthusiasm has just spread through
mm-hmm.
to the community. It's about community pride.
Right.
And this is just one of a number of things that Chattanooga should be proud of.
So, you know, in the last minute and a half, I actually want to hit that subject of the value. What is the value of civic pride as an economic driver?
Yeah, I don't know that you can value that. You can look at the, I guess, the sum of all the parts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got better operational efficiency, more reliable power. You've got access to broadband, all of which you can attach a value to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tremendous value. But when you look at the whole of that, I think it really makes Chattanooga or any community really virtually unstoppable.
Mm-hmm. So... would I be correct then in advising, you know, I do consulting when I'm not doing this bad boy of broadband exercise, you know, to basically tell people, look, you know, part of the impact, the economic impact that you're going to get from broadband is going to rely in a certain extent on to how much buy-in there is by the community and how you can harness that buy-in, that sense of civic pride, to drive your programs, whether it's, you know, how do you use a gig, you know, how do you employ a gig in, you know, in the medical care route. I mean, there's all these various, you know, ideas for how to do this that are kind of up there in, you know, business school level kinds of discussions. But it seems like, you know, at the ability to harness the civic engagement element is going to be what will drive the power of your broadband to eventually be an economic development tool.
I think it drives it beyond any monetary number that we could pin to it.
Excellent. Well, this, as always, has been a great conversation. You know, and I thank you for being on the show today, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. And thanks for letting me join you today.
No worries. Alrighty. You have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
All righty. We're going to shift gears here a little bit. I want to talk about, obviously, broadband, economic development, those key issues. It's interesting to note, you know, how different communities go about this. You know, one of the things that could lead folks into a troubled spot is to assume that one community's success can be replicated everywhere. And so you've got to look at large cities, and you've got to look at the medium-sized cities and so forth, and you have to look at smaller towns. So I think that, you know, one of the objectives of my show and my business is trying to define some of these issues on broadband and economic development based on, you know, who the type of community that we're talking about. And so our next guest is from a small town many people probably or may not have heard of, called Kutztown, which is in Pennsylvania. They are, again, you know, they're a small town, but they have big influence from the standpoint of they've been at this for 10 years, their community network. And I think one of the pushbacks, you know, we hear critics of community broadband is that these networks will never be successful. I somehow think that if you can be in this business for 10 years, be a small town, you've got a lot going on and you probably have a lot to say. And so in that vein, in that philosophy, our next guest is the IT director for the city, Frank Caruso, who I want to thank you for being a guest on the show today, and welcome. Welcome to the show.
I appreciate the opportunity to share a story.
Excellent.
Great opportunity.
So you have probably seen a lot and done a lot in 10 years that you guys have been around.
It's been an interesting experience. there was a lot of talk about us not making the first 2 years,
right?
5 years. That's kind of quelled down now.
Okay.
We are very well entrenched. Our community is supportive of our system. We continue to keep growing it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a very, very exciting time for us.
So tell us a little bit about how the project started, because 10 years ago, broadband wasn't a concept, really. I mean, there was internet access, kind of, sort of, but speeds were slower, and only small towns were really doing their own thing.
The way it started actually came about with our utilities, and we took a look at monitoring our electric utility system, our substations, our water system, and then actually trying to aggregate our buildings and offices and consolidate our networks together.
Mm-hmm.
It was a trip to Florida to a national conference where we first started to see the opportunity to reach the home with the technology of fiber. And back in 2002, this was all new pie in the sky kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You would not find this an affordable type of an operation, and you'd be able to put that kind of a network in place. But it was very intriguing. We had a borough manager that had an engineering degree. So when we started talking about this, we started to realize that we have the mechanisms to do this. We have
mm-hmm.
the workforce. We have ownership to right-of-ways. We
mm-hmm.
have access to properties. We have all the tools to put this together. We're in a little rural community. Nobody's paying attention to us. And at that time, as you said, you're dealing with one-way cable modem service. You're dealing with set-top boxes on low-end television type services. So the community, as a college community, just recognized that there was a need to help continue to sustain itself,
mm-hmm.
And become, you know, an independent type of an operator. Now, what's very interesting is I attended the first Fiber to the Home show.
Oh, really? So you are a veteran of this whole
absolutely
world.
and you know, you could have put two rows of people that were sitting in the room at that point in time. So the Fiber to the Home Council has just grown this at such a great pace. There's so many providers and options that are out there,
mm-hmm.
now. I wish they would have been out there at the time that we were doing this. Just the opportunity of being able to cooperative business ventures, just was not on the table at the time and available to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we did put RFPs out in order to find service providers. There was that build it and they will come kind statement going around. And, you know, we still had our own need and our own, you know, pieces that we had to actually deal with. And a new communications mechanism was core to that. And fiber was actually what that was. Now, expanding it out in order to do internet and television, we just felt would help the community out and then help us continue to keep growing that community.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of just dollars and cents, but keeping that community whole.
Right, okay. So folks there, even in a pioneering environment, understood the value, you know, even though it wasn't clear. I mean, you didn't have YouTube, you didn't have, you know, mega bandwidth as even an enticement or whatever, but it sounds like there were a number of people that had, I guess what my grandmother would call a worldly vision. You kind of sort of saw a bigger picture of where this might go and then decided to jump on it.
True, and what's really unique about Kutztown itself, they are just a perfect model of people wanting to be an independent operation.
Mm-hmm.
By doing their own electric, doing the water and sewer, they really wanted that community to be able to make changes to its system, control its own destiny. And so the type of people that sat on the council at that time had the vision. And I give them a lot of credit for being back in 2000 to have that type of vision when you're not seeing this actually happening across the country. So it really started off in 1996. It was a comprehensive plan. And part of that was what happens if deregulation of electricity takes place or our electric service and the cost of providing electricity starts to skyrocket? What do we do? And so they were looking at other ways of, we don't want property taxes driving this community.
Mm-hmm.
So what other ways would we be able to leverage the assets and infrastructure of what we have?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this was based off of that plan. And a couple studies were done to say, yes, it's feasible, you know, you can do it. And there were a couple studies that said, you know what, you're too small, you'll never be able to do it, you won't be able to compete. You know, the way that the incumbents are in place, they'll just drive you out of business from doing it. But we still had that own need within our own operations to
mm-hmm.
have this infrastructure in place. So regardless, that infrastructure has value to this community.
Right. And that brings up an interesting question. So I can't even remember where it was anymore that I heard this within the last month, that the first effort by a community should be to create an asset rather than to create a service. Because once you create an asset, people look at the asset and say, oh, we can do this because we have this asset. We can do X and Y because we have this access. Because we have this asset. We're not looking at it as, you know, am I going to get broadband? Or as Katie mentioned in her interview, you know, people come up and say, well, you know, can I get 100 channels? Right? Because people just now think of you as just another service, and they're already comparing you against the incumbents because they want to know, you know, what can I get? But when you create the asset, you create an asset, you say, well, this has value to the community because it opens up, you know, all of this technology options to us.
Absolutely.
And then your thinking changes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what happens with just putting that infrastructure in place, other things start to fall onto the table.
Uh-huh,
and now
right.
we start to be able to expand our thinking a little mm-hmm. bit and go beyond the traditional. And it's very important that the asset and that structure is just in place. And it's hard to envision what will tomorrow be like.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny this morning listening to about, you know, YouTube coming to life and Facebook and the number of users that are sitting on networks right now. We were looking at 1 to 2 people. We're looking at 6 to 8 now. You know, in a few years, we're going to look at 13 to 15 devices that are on from a single user. So where we're headed into this next generation is just, you know, amazing. This technology, though, puts us in that place to continue to be able to leverage that and continue to keep growing.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of a specific plan, what was the end game considered? I mean, when you started, I mean, obviously we know where it is now. I mean, what you have now, but when you were starting, what was the game plan? What were you really hoping to have at the end of some point in time?
The old saying, build it and they will come. What
right.
we were hoping for was an open access network of providers to
okay.
be able to bring services to the community. So there were choice.
Okay.
And a lot of choice. Not just one or two players, but whoever wanted to bring a service into that community had that ability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a driving force, you know, behind just putting it in place. Now, we do automated metering, so
mm-hmm.
our metering system was part of this, too, and putting that in place.
Mm-hmm.
But I think overall, what we were looking for was to improve the quality of life there.
Mm-hmm.
Empty houses, boarded up buildings, streets that can't be repaired is not a good community to...
Right. You don't have a lot of positive atmosphere there at that point.
Right, exactly. And I think that, you know, once you have that asset in place, you know, there is this, even though it was not that they would come because we build it,
mm-hmm.
okay? And it that really did not happen.
Okay.
But as you see this going on, I'm seeing it in other communities.
Mm-hmm.
Chattanooga is a perfect example. I mean, you get big businesses, and all of a sudden they're looking and they're seeing what kind of an infrastructure is there
mm-hmm.
that we can move our operation to, and what do you have? You've just got a mark on there. Business plan, and
mm-hmm.
They will come.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that just by having that infrastructure and having the capabilities of where we can reach with this, in our level to reach up to 100 meg that service at the home. But there are a lot of people, especially in a small rural community, that take a look at this and say, "What do we need that for?
Why do we need it?
You know, we really going to have that, but." What we're seeing is that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the requirement is going to be. And we're going to see more and more of this in-home type of technology to where bandwidth is going to be the driving force in order for that, a lot of that technology to work.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the audience, you know, when you talk about build it and they were come, were you talking about the providers?
Providers.
Right.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
I think that there is a body of thought that if you build the public service, and assume that people will come because you have it, that actually won't be the case. But if your target is the provider, you basically then want to provide to create a platform and say, here, come take advantage of that, I can see where the philosophy would make sense. So now, so what was the reality? You said that you did or did not get a lot of providers that wanted to jump on this thing.
We actually had zero providers at that time in 2002. Now, in talking to the large telcos, they did attend meetings, and they did come to the network design and the overview and heard what we were doing. But in the end, and a couple that I had talked to offline, the core of this is having a middleman and not owning the customer. It was a new business model to them that they were not ready to actually take on.
Hmm.
So when you take a look at a cable system that's running coax directly to the house, or a telephone company running lines directly, they have ownership of that customer. It's theirs. Stick a municipality in the middle of it that's running the line, and the service providers at the front end were maintained in line for them. It's reaching, well, now the value of their system has just gone down. They don't have ownership of that customer.
Mm-hmm.
So that thinking actually stopped a lot of providers from doing it.
Okay.
Now, with that said, a company, a small telco, DNA Communications, came to us and said, you know what, you're 26 miles away from us. We're not sure about this model because we've never done this before.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very concerned about a middleman into this. But we'll fiber to your location and do dial tone for you. So that brought dial tone service across our platform then.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, in essence, leasing the line from us. Now, on the television side, we had no takers. Internet side, we had no takers. And we opted to build our own and take on. So we hired an engineering firm that was experienced in both those in order to get that off the ground for us.
Mm-hmm. So it was basically then deciding to do the service because no one else would.
That's what it ended up, except for the small.
Now, when that smaller provider came, did they at least, I don't know, say, well, if this goes well, we may do more? Or was it pretty much, we're just going to do the dial-up and you probably shouldn't expect anything else from us?
They are primarily doing the telco side of it,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they were focused on doing.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to, about doing VoIP-type services, and that, but they had a different footprint that they were actually operating in, and by fibering to us, they crossed other areas. So
mm-hmm.
they stayed in their home plant, in their home area, but then dropped into our location to provide the service.
Okay. Now, when you started to do your own, was there opposition?
Yes.
Did that come later?
No. But it,
now, let me make sure I got this right now. So basically, you build a network and you say, look, here are these customers, here are these opportunities, and anybody that wants to come and play, this is open for you. And then everybody says no, there's a deafening silence. So you said, okay, well, fine. If you're not going to build it, we will go ahead and build it. And then the next thing that happens is the hammer falls, and all the big come and say, well, you can't do that.
Oh, absolutely. And,
okay.
And
we've seen this song before.
Oh, this is it. And what is really ironic, I mean, about this is you will not hear a word until you actually invest your money and build your network and get there. Everything's silent, okay? Wow, we're off the radar. Nothing's going to happen. You know, we're good here. As soon as you start talking about launch date, all of a sudden, you know, the flags are going up, the questions coming in, you've got people starting to take an interest. I mean, we actually had the both the FCC and the Public Utility Commission. Now, the PUC came to us and on site and wanted to see what this was all about.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing? You know, how's this going to work? And we had a nice full day session with them going over it, and they walked away and, you know, never heard a word again. The FCC looked at us and said, you know what, boy, this is, you know, something new. This is sounds really good, you know, with this,
uh-huh.
this is going well. But the resistance in Pennsylvania, unfortunately, became the state that launched legislation to prohibit any other
right.
municipal entities to actually deploy or build networks like ours. And so that stopped, and there's 68 electric municipalities in PA
mm-hmm.
that are prime to actually help build fiber networks within their communities so everything could be linked together.
Mm-hmm.
But that legislation put a stop to it all, and it actually stopped our borders too, put a fence around us from expanding outside our doors.
Okay, so it was an expansion glass ceiling as opposed to a you got to stop doing this.
It seems right, exactly.
Right.
So, and we had intentions on building wireless towers and being able to distribute bandwidth out to other communities,
mm-hmm.
You know, being able to help sister municipalities in that with broadband usage. But the legislation just crippled us and pretty much stopped us dead in our
mm-hmm.
tracks. And there's been other legislation since then to continue to keep doing it. Luckily, we were grandfathered in.
Mm-hmm.
But in February of 2011, legislation hit again in Pennsylvania, and this time there's no grandfathering clauses that's sitting in with us. That's kind of dormant, and it's sitting right now. And hopefully it doesn't go much further, but there's still a reluctance in having a small government or entity launch services like this.
Doesn't I don't know. I assume at the personal level, people understand that, you know, this claim that small towns have this great unfair advantage that will put the poor, pitiful giants out of business is all just crap. It's all just useless
stuff. It's bunk.
Stuff. And it's like, don't get me started. That'll be another show. Mm. But so how do you so it's because you're self-contained and okay, so you can't expand, but at least you can continue to thrive and maintain a steady state internal.
We can keep the lights, you know, keep those houses lit up and
right.
keep the streets maintained, and we can, you know, continue to improve our services. I mean,
right.
our police services and our cameras and that, and where we need to have things done. I mean, this it's invaluable
mm-hmm.
at this point. If we continue on with enhancing our smart grid technology and be able to manage that system better,
mm-hmm.
it's invaluable. The funny part about, you know, when you're talking about the unfairness in this, and one of the things that we've learned now, and we're trying to, and I recommend this to any municipality or city that's actually trying to go out and think about doing this, government and business under the same roof don't mix real well. And what I mean is you've got officials that have to run a government and try and run a business at the same time.
Right.
And there are laws, rules, regulations that the government portion of this need to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got a business side of this that we need to try to follow for competitive reasons. So what happens is, in order to make decisions, like when we launched, it took 60 days for us to get our information, everything on the books in order for us to be able to launch. Well, we had to release our product, our pricing, our game plan, everything about our system
mm-hmm.
prior to our launch ever taking place.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we went to launch, our competitor was there with lower prices, a different
right,
product, and
right.
something else. So every time there is something new for us to actually put out or we want to do a special event,
mm-hmm.
it has to go to the table, it has to get advertised, goes through the system, it's out in the open before we ever get there, and it's countered at
mm-hmm.
that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about and looking at our telecommunications pieces of this actually becoming like an operating authority,
mm-hmm.
so that there is actually a board made up of residents that manage that side of the operation, and then government stays here and does its government operation. That was a hard lesson to learn. Probably should have happened 5-6 years ago with us, but we're still under the same roof of, you know, government making the decisions from a business standpoint. So it cripples advertising, cripples promotions,
mm-hmm.
and we can't do as much as we really could as if we were running as being like a business. So
right.
that unfair advantage, we're getting killed by the unfair advantage. It's
right.
even bidding and buying products in that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. We have rules and ways that we have to go about doing that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't react right away.
So now, what would you call that separate entity?
An authority, like a management authority. It's kind of like water authorities have.
Oh, right. Okay. And then that would – now, does it, by creating a management authority, do you create an entity that by its – whatever it is that defines an authority that you don't have to put all this information out first? And
we can operate differently in a
okay.
more competitive
okay.
World.
Is it a hard thing to do?
No, it's actually up to the borough council
mm-hmm.
to actually decide to form the authority and then to find its members or interview its members and appoint them. The negative to doing something like that is the authority can create debt.
Right.
And it can create debt outside that government managing that.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a blend so that you can't have that authority run rampant and
right.
pay, let's say, high salaries or just spend money to create a large debt for the operation to
mm-hmm.
run. So that's one of the reasons why it just hasn't moved in that kind of direction. And I think that there was a city in Pennsylvania, and unfortunately the authority just kind of went rampant.
Oh, and spoiled it for everybody?
Spoiled it for everybody, yeah.
There's always
that's what happens. So, and every time we talk about it, it kind of goes back to that. Well, you saw what happened back there.
Right.
What's going to, you know, the same thing could happen here. But It kind of hurts us from a marketing perspective to be able to advertising,
mm-hmm.
Competitive advertising, knocks on service or something that we're doing. We can't do that in return.
Right.
So it puts us at a disadvantage. We can't answer back and
mm-hmm.
say, no, that's not true. You know, did you know this is what's really going on?
Right.
So it's just part of our world and something we've gotten used to. We're dealing with it constantly.
Like a toothache that won't go away, so you just deal.
And the, another unfair advantage is something, you know, that it still bothers me today, but it's the stimulus
mm-hmm.
monies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Kutztown, we went out for taxable bond debt in
right.
order to do our system, purposely, because we wanted private entities and players on our network. And to do that, we needed taxable money to be able to build that network.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When the stimulus package, so we have not gotten any funding or mm-hmm. done anything. Everything has just been on our own through our own effort.
Right.
We didn't raise taxes. We don't use tax money to do it. When the stimulus programs came out, and you know the president put these programs in order to really spearhead this broadband services and that. Very first thing that happened was legislation came out and said you can't get that and you can't apply for that kind of, that money. That was part of what we were hoping for in order to get 30 gig to the home and,
right.
and 100 to the home and that. I mean, backbone bandwidth and pricing is a tough ticket to deal with,
uh-huh.
and we can't raise our rates that high in order to be able to purchase that type of backbone in order to redistribute it into the town. So the stimulus money would have helped for us to get there and expand our whole network. But again, another piece of legislation, you're not going to be able to touch that, and it was in 2009.
Was it specifically you or just any city in the
any
state?
Any city in the state, any governing entity.
So what would be the likelihood of creating a co-op or some sort of nonprofit organization and do it, just get it done?
I would love it. I mean, it's a matter of rethinking again, and it's retooling our minds and our mindset and the way that business has just been done, you
mm-hmm.
know, for you know that's past few hundred years. I mean, there's too much blame, I think, on government taking control. I mean, we were referred to as the Republic of at one time, just because
the Republic of Kutztown?
Yeah,
oh.
just because of you know running our utility, but. It's the people in the town
right.
that have decided to do this and to put their monies into it. It's not outdoor funding or, you know, grants coming in to do this thing. And the people who are elected are the neighbors that are making the decision and say,
right.
we want to progress forward.
Which is sort of the absurdity of the whole thing because ultimately, in theory, we are a voting democratic republic. And so, you know, the community, the people, the voters, if they decide to have a team of orangutans run the network, then they vote them in of sound mind and body.
Right.
That should be the end of it.
And we should have a right to be able to make our own decisions within our own communities to say, hey, this is what we really want to do. It's not to knock out private business.
Right.
If there was not a need,
you wouldn't have it in the first place.
Right.
Right. You wouldn't have the votes. You wouldn't have the
exactly.
support.
And, you know, I laugh at when somebody or I read an article or something that talks about Kutztown failing, right? Oh, we must be doing something right because they keep writing legislation trying to stop us from doing that. It's confusing to me.
Oh, I know what you mean. It's so coming back to the nonprofit thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are place I'm sure you probably have heard of some of them, like EC Fiber up in Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
They created a nonprofit, 501c, and they, you know, all the cities in the 23 or 25 communities elect a person to be on the board, but the board person isn't part of government, so it's totally a government separate entity, and off they go. They raise money, they sell, in essence, investments by
mm-hmm.
via promissory notes. And they build the network. And in Steuben County, they have a community foundation has created the dark fiber network, and they sell businesses access to that, and the business go and find a provider to turn it on. So I bring these up to say that there are successful examples of nonprofit entities that are created by the community, that are run by the community to bring broadband into the community. And, you know, and looking at Pennsylvania, you know, I sort of wonder, well, even in other places as well, well, so what happens if there's a mass movement to create co-ops? Because that's basically, you know, number one, it's non-government. So you can't ever, you can never call, accuse it of being a government entity because it's not.
Mm-hmm.
In some respects, it is a business. Granted, it's a 501c, but, you know, mm-hmm. those things are all, there are tax laws that say you can do those. And then, you know, and then ultimately it either exists or it doesn't exist because the community supports it or they don't support it. And so.
Exactly. And I think you hit it right on the head. It's the community that's actually making and driving the ship in order to make that kind of a change. An interesting point, I mean, I need to talk to a couple of solicitors here to take a look at this, because I'll tell you, it would be, it would behoove a lot of, you know, locations. I mean, let's face it, people don't realize this, and I laugh sometimes when I see these stickers by some of the larger providers.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, they've got broadband here and have it here, and a little star, right?
Mm-hmm.
That star covers half the state or the whole state, and they got two locations that are sitting there, and the other 150 communities have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, somebody's looking at this map and going, well, it's there, so let's stay away from there because it's already taken place.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, there are still places that are still, you know, coming off the one-way cable modem services.
Wow. Uh-huh.
And places that, that their television services are just 80 channels, 100 channels, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And they're void from moving forward into this whole broadband thing. What amazes me is we're running and we're doing 8 meg up, 8 meg down for our customers.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hearing 30. And I'm hearing 50 from other communities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly where we plan to be within the next year here.
Right.
And the reason for it is the activity, the number of devices and what's happening in
right.
the market here.
Mm-hmm.
And HD television and everything that's going across us, the requirement for that is going to be there. Businesses and what they're planning on doing. We're watching the internet improve a lot of business, a lot of small business
mm-hmm.
and sales now. Well, the traffic on this is just escalating to the point to where it's going to be a requirement for us to be putting 30 meg
right.
in that house for
mm-hmm.
50. Xbox Live, I mean, you know. I can
Katie, bar the door.
We watch this thing and that meter flies through the ceiling up here, you know, and it stays up there and we can see, holy
mm-hmm.
cow, that, look what's going on, Netflix,
mm-hmm.
streaming,
mm-hmm.
I mean. That's the next generation of where all this is going. It's not going to stop. It's not going to go backwards.
Right. It never goes backwards.
Yeah. And I think that I think communities, especially these electric communities, have that the perfect tool for cooperative business with an entity.
Mm-hmm.
What I heard today was there are players that will go into a community and say, you know what, if you're willing to put some skin on the table, we'll put some skin on the table and we'll build a network.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that opportunity when we were doing Kutztown at that
true.
Point.
Uh-huh.
So I'm looking at that and going, my goodness, here, what are you asking for? You're looking for right-of-ways? You're looking for the rights on
mm-hmm.
to sewer systems, to, you know, the neighborhood, the marketing assistance, you know, the market to be able to bring in? It's a great opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that here, and I was talking about this morning, what we see here in the attendees for the fiber to the home, who should be here, some of the mayors and some of the council people and some of the decision makers,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
they should be able to hear this, the story, hear the what's happening and why and where the next generation is going. I mean, let's face it, we're building these networks and what's going to be in place is for our future.
Uh-huh.
They're the ones that are going to recognize the advantage to doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually that coax and DOCSIS system is just not going to be able to keep up with what's required down the line. And so fiber is actually the gateway to go. To get it out there and deployed in these rural areas and get it out there faster, I think the cooperative efforts is the only way to actually make that happen. You know, it's just a matter of getting to the table, discussing it, and finding a route.
Mm-hmm. So what is the receptivity level of mayors to this kind of a message? Because, I mean, one, I agree with you. Yes, more mayors need to hear this. But I also will go to some conferences, and there will be some county representative or a city representative, city council representative, and he'll be like 28 and be all gung-ho about, you know, the technology and the network. And then that person will go, but sometimes, you know, we have these other city council people, and they're like 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't even begin to understand the concept, you know. And it goes, my problem is I can't convince those folks. Is it possible that if we were to get those people to events like this, would they change their mind? I mean, is it, you know, can they see the light? Can enough of them see the light?
I really believe they could.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that they're just kind of living in a little cocoon at this point in time and just not realizing that there's a whole different world that's out there, and there's a necessity for that world. What's stopping them from actually doing it, and you know, to be truthful, candid, if you have business, and business is supporting you in order to be able to, you know, get into office, maintain office, and whatever, that's power
mm-hmm.
out there.
Mm-hmm.
They're the power brokers for the decisions that are, you know, these elected officials are making. So it's difficult from their standpoint to try to go on both sides of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, I'm really in favor of this, and I really think it would be a great thing. But you know what? I got private business over here, and that private business is saying to me, wow, what are you going to do next? Babysitting services? Paving services? Grass cutting services? You know, where are you going to stop?
The power of the absurd assumption.
Exactly. And so they have to balance between both worlds,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes a difficult mechanism, I think, for any elected official.
Right.
And then, you know, in Kutztown's case, we have 6 elected officials, council members.
Mm-hmm.
3 of them, and they run 4-year terms. So every 2 years, we're looking at rotation.
Right, people, right.
Unless they maintain their office. Well, now you're getting if a couple of those change, now we got a new breed of thinking coming in. So it's like a re-education.
And you right have again. To start it right.
And that was one of the reasons about talking like an authority, because it stays consistent and the players are there
until
you know, they decide to leave. So, yes, I believe that it is difficult. And from an aid standpoint, I mean, let's face it, we ran into a lot of resistance from our own utility superintendents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
You're talking about people that are in place, have been in place for 25, 30 years. Okay, now
wow.
we're talking about a technology
mm-hmm.
coming into play that's just blowing the windows off everything. And now you're asking them to like adopt this technology, and it's a tough thing to do.
Right.
And I think that you know, if you're not into the IT and into this whole technology concept, you're used to this wire, you know, landline type thing, dropping in something that, you know, we can't see, touch, and deal with, is now a whole different world to deal with. So there was reluctance, you know, from that end of it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just the generation that's coming up and the generation that's actually starting to take fold on councils and that is a generation that this is a requirement for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're realizing that it's a requirement for their children.
Right.
So I think we'll see that transition overall, and I just think the word needs to be out. Those officials just need to learn
mm-hmm.
or see more about and not rely on, let's say, the large incumbent guys that they're coming. They'll be on
right.
your doorstep.
Right. Well,
some
all the power
point in time or something,
yeah.
you know. And in most cases, you're seeing people move because they realize it's just not going to happen.
Right.
And I need it for my job, or my kids need it for this.
Right.
Or, you know, we want our children to have a better education platform. We want this
mm-hmm.
internet, you know, services. It's not happening, so we need to move on.
Right. Now, is it possible, or let's talk about a slightly different dynamic. I understand the issues that an elected official has when the big incumbent comes in and says, you know, government shouldn't be here and yada, 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 getting the whole socialism guilt trip. But if the business community, if the local business community rallied around and said, you know what, we need this as a business economic development issue, Would that give the council and the mayors a little more spine and vision?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what would it take to
get the voice of the people? And the voice of the people, and you can see it, I mean, just in our world, 51% of the market is there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a strong voice that, hey, this thing is working.
Mm-hmm.
We have 1,250-some people on here. You're not going to just turn that off and say, hey, I don't think it's good for you.
No.
You know? What I think is, you know, we need to go back and just let the private guy do this kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. That voice, but here's what happens, and I see this. Everything is smooth and it's great because they have it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry about it. I go home, I turn my TV on, I have my TiVo and I have my stuff and I'm streaming. I got my broadband and everything is good.
Right.
Until it's going to be taken away from you and it's becoming a reality that it's going to end,
mm-hmm.
that's when the voices will come back. And nobody makes noise when things are going well.
Right.
It's when it
right.
starts to go, you know, turn the other way that they'll start to come out. So right now you kind of be you're spoiled a little bit
mm-hmm.
and it's just, it all looks good. But in a lot of sense, you got to be real careful about what's happening, you know, on the, and behind the doors and that here
mm-hmm.
because you can, there can be a destructive faction. And trying to down these services or say, you know, I always get this. Okay. One of the largest telcos, man, they're going to be on your doorstep here in 2 years. Well, we waited 2 years. There's no sight of them at this point. Right? So I get it again. I got it the other day. I got a document from somebody that attended the conference and said, hey, look out. They say they're on your doorstep. You know, I go back out, start looking around. There's nothing there. So I think a lot of times, and this is what I think happens in Harrisburg, unfortunately, believe that a plan is put on a table and that stops everything. So
it's like when Microsoft would come to town in a big corporation, and then all of a sudden, any discussion of any other product except for Microsoft just stops.
Right. Now you've got this unlimited time for them to come in.
To
right?
muck around and
so
jump around.
As soon as you say you want to expand or move into the next generation of something, right? Oh no, they're telling us
they're
doing
do it.
And
they're
here's
do
their
bio.
Plan to do that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and that thing and it's gonna be in a year here and a perfect example of this, I was in hearings, okay, 10 years ago, right?
Right.
Okay. And I'm sitting at this hearing, and we're going back and forth, and there's this one senator, he says, well, wireless is going to be the answer. Why are you guys doing this? Because
help me.
This is, you know...
I thought that was only North Carolina.
No.
No, clearly
no,
not.
I totally believe that wireless is going to be the godsend of everything that's going to happen. This is 10 years ago, right? Now, eventually, wireless is going to get to a point of it, but the fiber backhaul is always going to be there, no matter
right.
how you look at it.
Something's got to connect to a wire.
Something's got to do it. So in that discussion, they're doing this. So the next thing that happened is a large incumbent sits there and says, we are building out, and we will have Pennsylvania covered within 10 years
uh-huh.
for broadband.
Uh-huh. And
okay,
they want
guys,
subsidies.
Thank you very much for coming. We'll see you later. Oh, yeah, tax breaks out of the law.
Right.
Well, it's nice, Kutztown, for you to come down here and talk about this, right? But they're saying they're going to take care of it. It's done. Well, we're 10 years here, and I'm still sitting here, and I'm looking up north in, you know, these areas and that, and there's not a line running anywhere near anybody. So, you know, it stopped everything.
Right.
And I think that that's just a lot of what happens as soon as there's some noise or some venture, or like
right.
you were saying, let's say there's three cities that want to band together, like the Tri-Cities tried to do in mm-hmm. Indiana and
mm-hmm.
Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the negative, you know, press and the look out, and it's scaring senior citizens. This is another big one.
Right.
Who's voting? Senior citizens aren't coming out in the core voters, right? Scare them that
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden taxes are going to go in, and all of a sudden the cost of your home is going to go through the roof. You're not going to be able to afford to run these networks and that. And so they put the fear of God in them. And, you know, these people sit back, and again, they're looking at it and saying, what do we really need it for? Is it really going to be an impact to us or
mm-hmm.
make a change in our life?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I'm just a firm believer, and I think cooperative efforts is the way to go and actually get this broadband in the rural areas and get it, you know, in play faster.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at when I take a look at what they're doing in Netherlands, Belgium, and these other countries, and how fast they're deploying compared to the U.S. I mean, it just it blows my mind that the creativity in what they're doing. We should be doing much better than what we are right now.
Right. Now, now this is kind of embarrassing because I'm actually from Philadelphia.
Okay.
And
well, you went through the wireless street.
They went through it. I was in California. But, yes, they did go through it. But that was my first book. I mean, that's how I got here, was writing about Philadelphia's, effort to get broadband, of which, you know, I made the Verizon thing somewhat a sidebar, as it were, because I was more focused on how they did their planning. But, you know, but over the course of time, I've given, you know, lots of ink to the to these issues. And, you know, it has always amazed me how, the predictability of the attack, the verbiage of the attack, it's always the same stuff. And yet you seem, not you, but the community seem to have the same set of dynamics that gets in their way. There's either older or less progressive council people who start to quake at the idea of, you know, competing against the government. And in the same way, it's sort of at the mayoral level, right? And then you have the general population that kind of sees, oh, all these things fail, you know? I mean, I would contend that, it's time to, if you've got 65 communities in Pennsylvania where the mindset is such that people understand that what is existing currently doesn't work, that if someone walks in and says, hey, tell you what, we can do a community foundation, because if the same, 500 people that want broadband, better broadband, are willing to pay for what Kutztown has, right? Well, they're going to be the same 500 people that if someone forms a cooperative or forms a nonprofit will still be there to say, hey, and that'll make the business case and all the rest of it. In other words, take the weak need, non-understanding segment off the table, the same way that the big companies say, okay, we'll build that, and all of a sudden all of the power structure goes, oh, well, we're not going to talk about anything else, then say, look, an alternative entity comes and says, we'll build that, and, you know, and shift the discussion.
You're right. And I think that, unfortunately, I believe the Tri-Cities actually tried to do that.
Is that Pittsburgh and a couple other?
No, that was actually Indiana, Illinois, and I can't think of the other one right now. But that was like 7 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Tried to create a centralized hub for distribution of broadband, television, and the works.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, they were competing with Comcast at that point in time. So there was a huge, marketing blitz.
Mm-hmm.
On why, this will never work, why it can't take off. It went to referendum, and I think two of the three voted it down, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of it had to do with the fear factor that was put in. What would happen if the network failed? You're going to be stuck with all this debt. You know, what is going to happen with it? In reality, you're building that asset.
It's an asset.
That's an asset.
It stays around.
Somebody's going to come and buy that thing. I mean,
right.
They are going to they're going to want that asset. It's not just going to hang there and be dormant.
Right.
I mean, it's the future piece that can connect two cities together,
mm-hmm.
and somebody's in the middle and it's not running, well, somebody's going to take it over and do something
right.
with that.
It's just a question of who that someone is and if they actually want to make it run. Now, by the same token, so the third guest yesterday says that, one of them, he's also a big proponent of the co-op or nonprofit, because he goes, it just takes all that political crap off the table,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, someone needs it, because that becomes a distraction, that becomes the anchor, that becomes the gating factor. If you make it a political issue, depending on your, your state and the politics and who runs which part of the, legislative branch, that's a deal killer, right? But if you take the politics off the table, and you flip it back around to say, okay, we're going to have, you know, a community-run organization, a nonprofit, you know, Peter says it's just, it's the better way to go.
I agree with that. I think that would help improve this whole overall, you know, stigma of government doing business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
mm-hmm.
that would just give a whole new credence into an opportunity and a you know, an effort to actually be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot behind that. And, you know, CORE is you have solicitors that are government solicitors and, you know, and taxpayer dollars doing battle against a private guy. You
right.
want to be really careful with that, because we don't want tax dollars being tied up in court systems and
right.
you know, frivolous
right.
things that in the end it's going to come out to some kind of negotiated deal, or it's just going to fall off the table. But you expended a tremendous amount of money. And let's face it, the pockets of that town and that city are just not that deep to go
right.
about taking
right.
that on. So, you know, there's a lot of this, avoid that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the nonprofit, you know, idea. Now, guaranteed, if I went back to Pennsylvania and went around and said, you know what, let's organize into a nonprofit organization. Let's get two or three cities or towns, municipalities, get together, and let's bring this to light, right?
Mm-hmm.
We would probably have three lawsuits and questions hit the fan before we ever got off the table. And we would more than likely have solicitors within those communities saying, you know what, guys? You know, you're going to be in for a long-term battle here. It could cause a lot of issues. Do you really want to take it on? So the sure factor comes back in again.
Right. And it becomes an exercise in determining, you know, who's willing and how willing to fight those battles. I mean, you know, if I look at the country as a whole, and I look at where these kinds of issues are coming into play. See, one of the I think points that gets missed in the discussion is that there really isn't a business case, right? None of these incumbents seem to do this in a place where there is a business case for them to serve it. And in fact, AT&T is going around the country trying to get legislation passed in states to remove their obligation to provide universal service. Right, they're trying to get the laws off the books.
Mm-hmm.
Right, why are they doing that? Because they don't want to serve those communities. Right, it seems to me that they only chase after municipalities that want to do this in an area that they've already turned down because it's the Mongo effect. You know, like from Blazing Saddles, right? They send out Mongo,
yep.
and Mongo only knows one thing, which is to kill. It's like their only way to deal with the hint of a competitive
right.
threat. But what you see happening in some places is, well, once that community gets going, you know, it has to be a decent-sized community for the incumbent to engage. Because for some of these smaller places, they hint at it, but they're not really there.
Right.
My point being that as the folks in New Hampshire, or not Vermont, said, EC Fiber, when you get when you take the battle point off the table, which is basically the government running it, and you say a bunch of community people are going to do it on their own, then the incumbent looks over and goes, well, just how much misery do I want to go through?
Mm-hmm.
Because how much of a threat are they going to really be? In other words, it becomes a more rational thought. Or as another person pointed out, they only make a big deal because they don't want to have 100 other cities all of a sudden want to do the same thing.
The virus effect.
The virus effect.
That's exactly what
right.
it comes into. And you hear that in a conversation. Well, if this one gets off the ground and it starts going, this is going to be like a virus.
Right.
And once that starts spreading, our networks, and here's the core of it. I lose that city of 2,000, or I lose that little town of 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to battle with this. They're just a pebble anyway. But what you're talking about is a value of maybe $5,500, $8,500 per home off the value of their overall system. So if they want to sell that little town, that thing may be worth $1.2 million. It's gone if somebody else is sitting in the middle of 50% of the market
right.
in there. So all of a sudden, that combination of, wow, you know what, here's this co-op that's trying to form. And the Midwest is great with the co-op kind
right.
of thing. I
mm-hmm.
mean, you know, I'm impressed with what they do. I mean, it's great. It's a great model of everything. Why it's not adopted over to our eastern side? Yeah, you know, it's horrible. But if you look at it, that, you know, even purchasing in that too. I mean, it's just a great way of actually mm-hmm. bringing all your resources together. But you know, in the end, that little deal of, boy, this thing could spread, and if it does, it is going to cause us all kinds,
right?
You know, of problems. Now, against a large telco kind of a person, they might say, you know what, that is too small an area, and we don't want it anymore. Just let them go.
Right.
But if you have a, let's say, a smaller operator, and that operator has, you know, 2, 3, 4 little places, has 125,000 customers or something like mm-hmm. that, you're infringing on their territory. How dare you? And we've
right.
been here forever. And you know what? You're putting egg on our face by invading our area and mm-hmm. on our territory. And in essence, really, if they just turned around and turned this thinking around a little bit and say, you know what? If I got those 2, 3, 4 cities to work with me, to improve that infrastructure.
We open business opportunities.
We open business opportunities, exactly.
Right. But
exactly.
They can't get past the Mongo effect.
Can't get past, exactly. You know, yeah, we got to squash somebody somewhere.
You know, it's kind of a ridiculous thing. So, you know, this has been a good conversation about, you know, what things are happening from the small town, you know, perspective in what I would consider a hostile hostile climate. Do you think that, I don't know, inertia is on your side? What I mean by that is the inertia of moving toward bigger, better, faster bandwidth. I mean, that's the driver.
Mm-hmm.
And either the local government is going to look and say, you know, we either get it or we lose these people, and then we disappear as who we are as a community, right? The inertia moving in that direction, is that going to at some point just tip a point and say, boom, we're gonna fight for the broadband. We're gonna find new ways to approach it. Maybe we'll get around the law, whatever the deal is. But we're at a spot we can't defend this position anymore. We have to get this broadband stuff in here.
From our perspective, just being a single and small community, I think that the way that we look at it is it doing what we expect it to do?
Mm-hmm.
And is it of value to us? And now we're a model saying, yes, it does work. Yes, it
mm-hmm.
is good. And boy, it could be much better. Now, you know, and looking at us and saying, yes, look at, they are surviving, and they're surviving the legislation, they're surviving the advertising, they're surviving, you know, the free giveaways and, you know, the things that happen in competition.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if we can continue to stay in place and we continue to have a good story to this, that model will help, and especially in Pennsylvania, release, you know, take the strings off a bit
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
then start that growth. And like you said, I think that if other communities were to come and say, hey, you know what, Kutztown, we want to band with you and get together, and we want to make a statement in Harrisburg that we really, truly do need to expand your network out to help us too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it could gain momentum on that part to do it.
Right.
The problem is getting the word out.
Mm-hmm.
And just like this, you know, the fiber to the home council and the meetings and this and, you know, blog radio here. It falls on deaf ears after a period of time. Everybody's just kind of like moseying on, you know, we just forget about it, you know, and then
uh-huh.
the next thing, it's a hot topic all over again. And,
right.
I think as more and more devices are coming out, and I think as this next generation of children are coming up, and these college kids, they're demanding it. Their world and their professional world is going to demand this type of technology.
Right, exactly.
And I think they're the ones that are going to be the voice that are going to actually start taking shape and saying, why are we not doing
mm-hmm.
this? And then they're going to be the ones that are going to be less fearful
mm-hmm.
of taking it on and saying, let's really fight this out and grow this, you know, these networks and,
mm-hmm.
and do something with them.
Interesting. So does local support remain strong?
It does. It does. You know, you still have, you know, a group, and there are groups of people that believe truly government should not be competing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I can understand the position, but we, 51% is there's really literally no other community that's taken that kind of mm-hmm. kind of a take rate, and the Kutztown residents are just unbelievable for being there
right.
for that. The best part is they know where to go if they have a problem,
right.
and they have a voice in this. We formed a telecommunications advisory commission 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's just made up of residents. They drive the network. And where do we want to go next? What do we want to do?
Mm-hmm.
What do we want council to take on and
mm-hmm.
improve our system
mm-hmm.
with? And so that voice and just their ability to be able to pick up the phone, call us, and say, hey, you know what? There's a new channel or some new things we would like to see. You've got somebody to reach out to. And so that support is there. There's another part of this, okay? As government...
Mm-hmm.
We have a police department. We have a code enforcement office. And we're trying to sell retail services, okay, to a world where they may get upset with something at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, well, you know, I support your services, but I got this parking ticket. So, you know. And then you have the other group that's like, no, you're not putting that box on my house. Because your police department is going to be able to see everything I'm doing and what we're into. So there are people that truly believe that, you know, but they'll go on the internet and go on cable modem and not realize that, holy cow, the whole world's seeing what you're doing.
Right, they're on Facebook. You know, they're talking about how much their boss sucks on Facebook.
Yeah,
it's
and they're worried about the viral. Because, you know, we know everything that's done. Well, you know, it's just not there. But, the biggest opposition, I think, and when I look at it, is it's not so much people in town living within the community
mm-hmm.
and businesses that you know live and operate in the community. It's outsiders. It's the outside people that
outside
don't have
agitators.
This kind of thing,
exactly.
right? And it's like, boy, and I liken it to like a little child, like. If I can't have it, and I can't have that good price, well, I don't want you to have that either. So, you know, you get this kind of thing, you know, it's like, well, you know, we've got a provider in town here. That should be good enough for what we're doing. But these networks, and in our case especially, what happens is in a new build or a network that comes into place,
mm-hmm.
that current incumbent is going to improve their service.
Right.
They are going to improve their system. If they want to compete into it, they are going to go gung-ho and make things better within that community because now it's a true competition that they're going to have to deal with, and it forces their hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we found that. I mean, that's exactly what happened. I mean, the services, like, overnight, you know, just went from one-way cable modem service and, you know, a standard, you know, 256K modem kind of thing, you know, all of a sudden, well, we're doing two-way cable modem and, you know, we've got... 200 channels of television now, and I think that just helped balance it so much. So it's a win-win in Kutztown
mm-hmm.
for the 51% that we have and 49% that we don't, because price structure came down.
Mm-hmm.
They are getting the attention.
Right.
I mean, they are getting the attention. They've got a complaint. You know, everybody knows they're going to go over to the other side. So you need to stay up on them,
mm-hmm.
and you need to keep the system growing, and you need to stay on top of the technology type
mm-hmm,
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the past technology, we sat there on the telcos now for 75 years, right, without changing anything. We don't
right,
need to.
Right, right, right.
Right? Cable modem service. I'm sitting there, not real old in that, okay, but you're sitting here in traditional cable service for 50 years and not doing anything. Well, today's technology is changing. Yeah, I mean, every 50 days, somebody's
announcing something.
Something's
new.
Coming out, and it makes it that much you know, much better, and that's
mm-hmm.
the next thing that,
mm-hmm.
that's heading out. So, I mean, I'm so excited about the future. I think that it's great. I think that with the fiber to the home council and what I heard today from providers of service,
mm-hmm.
especially,
mm-hmm.
knowing that there are people that are out there and businesses that are out there that are willing to go into a community and willing to build a network and really are just saying to you, we're not just going to come in and do it all ourselves. You need to help us with something.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that is, you know, open up the right-of-ways, the pole attachment, you know, rights,
mm-hmm.
The marketing, you know, get us to the customer kind of thing. There's a world there that they could blend into, and it will get that network in place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's that's just important that they can just start doing that.
Mm-hmm. So we're about to transition here in a minute or two, but from an economic development standpoint, small town, what's the population of Kutztown?
About 5,500.
5,500 and so forth. What would be the two, three biggest economic development impacts that having this network has brought to the town?
What I see is I see a lot of growth in a lot of home businesses. Okay?
Aha, yes.
A lot of home business. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of Main Street businesses doing a lot of business on the web.
Okay.
Okay, more so. I'm seeing other – we have a couple larger businesses in that too where they've taken our service and the broadband part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing things that they could not do before. They were doing by some other means.
Right, right.
So we gave them that mechanism to get there. We had a company that was a production company from California that
mm-hmm.
actually moved
mm-hmm.
one of their offices into Kutztown so that we could get them the service and continue to keep providing a level of service for them to be able to have their home base in California. So there is it's very difficult when you start to say let's measure the economic growth and what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you take a look around your town. You take a look at how many homes are not vacant.
Mm-hmm.
How many businesses are not vacant? You know, what are the streets like when you're driving down them? Are they bumpy? Are they smooth? You know, what is it? So in our core statement and value is money recycles within the community.
Mm-hmm.
What we are making now, we're not looking and not sitting out there in an entity to where we have shareholders per se that are going to, you know, looking for 40, 45% profitability on this. We need to make enough to sustain the system, put enough money back into the general fund, and help pay for our police and our code office and our streets and our parks and that. We need to be a contributor just like our electric and our water and sewer utilities are in order to keep our millage and our property taxes down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it all is. If I did a calculation, and it was a rough calculation on the number of customers and usage and what the rates are, surrounding area, what people are getting for cable modem service, let's say bundled service and internet, and Kutztown. And I went to a 10-year platform. You know, it's Kutztown and the lowering of its rates and our competitor lowering their rates and bringing things down,
mm-hmm.
we're looking at about $8 million in a 10-year period of
mm-hmm.
monies that's just either recycling or it's in the home. It's
mm-hmm.
in the home. It's about $350 to $375 per house that has money to do something else
mm-hmm.
that they need to do, whether it's groceries, medical, or whatever. But those prices never would have come down had this other network not been put in place
mm-hmm.
for that. And you're not going to just see an overbuilder come into a lot of communities or towns
mm-hmm.
today. I mean, it's just too expensive.
Great. Well, this has been both informative and lively. I am actually glad to get a little more of the insight to what's happening in the Pennsylvania political side of this discussion because I've been following it since 2005. So it's been a real interesting battle. And it's nice to see that you guys have survived and your service does well and your customers stay loyal.
Yeah.
51% take rate, that's golden. That's pretty golden.
I do appreciate your time.
No worries.
Meeting you and
we'll,
I had a
we'll
great
get
opportunity
you on the show again sometime.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Take care.
So that's been a good breakdown. I mean, I think people who have followed me know that, you know, I tend to be very vocal, with probably a minor statement in terms of the, you know, a lot of the political issues that surround communities and broadband. But I think that there's a lot of important benefits that these networks bring, and they've got to stay in the game. They've got to stay in the game. So now I want to shift a little bit. I think just about everybody who definitely follows me, but I mean, who follows broadband, knows that the Utopia Network is a good project that is the object of a lot of slings and arrows that is just sometimes off the chart, and you kind of go, so what's really the deal? So I figure, well, if you really want to know the deal, you got to bring the people involved that make that network work and ask them. Let's get down to the heart of the matter, unfiltered. And so I have brought on the show today Todd Marriott, who is the executive director of Utopia. And Todd, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here on the show. And let's set the record straight. You guys are doing well, and you're going to be here for a long time. But what's going on in Utah these days?
Well, there's a lot, certainly a lot of press. I guess that's what you're referring to.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And so, you know, I gather, because I've also talked to you know, some of the folks in different cities that are part of the Utopia network. You know, and the consensus I get is that the service is doing well. The product is a good product. The project is a sound project, but you know, it's not getting favorable press because there are folks who don't like it. And so, you know, so give us a sense. I mean, you were on the show before, and we've talked about, you know, what Utopia is up to. But what is its progress to date? Let's just start with, you know, a status report on where, you know, how many cities do you have that are part of the group? You know, what kind of take rates are you guys seeing? Where is the project these days?
I think, to put it in perspective, Craig, I think you look back 4 years ago, just at a snapshot and look at a time where Utopia was facing even more serious threats with the RUS,
mm-hmm.
Having pulled back funding that they shouldn't have pulled back, and they hadn't dug ditches in over a year. The network was in jeopardy, very serious jeopardy at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The service providers were really non-existent, and there wasn't anything occurring on the network. And if you fast forward from that time to today, you see a very robust, redundant network that is providing extremely good service, connectivity, and is growing at a good clip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Utah, it's a very conservative red state.
True.
A lot of people look at programs with government with a lot of criticism anyway,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of misunderstanding. I think it goes into the Utopia project because of that. Detractors will use that minutia at oftentimes to put forward probably their own agendas.
Mm-hmm.
Utah Taxpayers Association, for example,
right,
is an organization that is a lobbyist group, and you know, they're two of their top clients and members are, you know, CenturyLink now, Comcast Quest, Xfinity, however they
mm-hmm,
want to name
mm-hmm.
it, and those incumbent providers put a lot of pressure on that group to come out in vocal opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a good job at putting out minutia that wasn't accurate. So a little over a year and a half ago, the Utah Taxpayers Association did put forward some numbers that weren't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
They were notified that such was the case. They put them forward anyway. Some citizens were upset with what was put forward, went to the representatives who saw this as an opportunity politically to put forward again another legislative audit.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been going through a legislative audit for nearly a year and a half, completed somewhere this June of this year.
Mm-hmm.
The audit, they self-admit, dealt 85% or more with issues and mistakes and so forth that had happened pre-2008.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it's been couched and espoused as being the current status of Utopia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no doubt that Utopia has its challenges.
Right.
It was $185 million in debt when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
They have struggled forward and are producing a business plan now that is working.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, is that what we talked about when you changed the business model, or is there a different, like an add-on to the business plan that you're describing as the business plan? I remember that when you and I talked when I wrote my book, and then you were on the show, right? Well, we talked about when you got there, things were kind of a mess because of the initial approach didn't turn out to be the right approach. And then you came on and restructured things. And that was part of the getting residents to do like a buy-in to get the network extended to their property. And that turned things around. You know, I guess revamping the wholesale model, which had been the original model, turned things around. Have you been doing additional stuff, or has it been the execution of that plan that you and I discussed about 2 years ago that's continuing to move forward and keeping things on track?
Well, we do continue to get better
mm-hmm.
at executing that plan and providing tweaks, I guess, Craig, to it, to that to that business model, it makes sense. I think that there are a lot of things that we're doing that is furthering some, I guess, as you put it, add-ons to that business model. It's, it's proving very successful. Let me give you a case in point. Last year, we finally approved a $65 million plan. We drew on that to the tune of $29.5 million. The debt coverage on the $29.5 million is about $2.1 million per year. We got a late start, tsunamis in Japan. Everything. But that said, you know, the legislative audit put a big graph on the screen showing that we missed our projections on subs, on subscriber counts significantly, which we did. But they, what they failed to show was that for that same period of time, 10 of the 12 months, we were ahead of our revenue projections. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, we made our first payment on that bond from revenues generated from that tranche and covered the bond. And so we are now, I guess, in terms of that, eating what we kill. Our biggest challenge to date in Utopia remains that we are still operationally not at break even. So we're covering our debt as we take out plus a margin, but we've got to make serious inroads now into covering our operational deficits.
Now, is that an operational deficit moving forward or an operational deficit created somewhere in the past?
Well, it, it really doesn't matter. It just continues to be an operation deficit. As we grow and we make additional revenues and we're getting bigger, faster, stronger, we still are recognizing that there's a gap that exists in terms of, you know, all the debt we have to cover. And then in terms of operationally, we don't make enough yet to cover both our ongoing debt plus, you know, the bite into the operations. And so that is what we're trying to do over the next 2-3 years is get to the point where we can be at a break even on operations, $185 million aside.
Right. So, I mean, but and I'm not a finance person, but to kind of maybe simplify, it is the magnitude of the debt that really is like this. I mean, it's like any organization. I mean, if you took a lot of debt or you accumulated a lot of debt in, say, its early days, and we'll talk about, you know, before you guys became part of Utopia, that debt sort of just, it hangs on until you can pay it. But it always becomes a thing that I've got to make today's rent and I got to, you know, retire some percentage of the outstanding debt. It would be sort of like if all of a sudden if someone forgave the entire debt, then you'd be cool because you're running a solid business that takes care of all of the, you know, the operating expense, the OPEX, I guess, would be.
Yeah, and I wish that were even a fair depiction. I think our concern is we're not covering the back $185 million. I mean, that debt was spent before I got there. What we're doing right now is as we take money and invest it, now we're covering any new debt with revenues. But what would be fair to say is that Utopia is a very large system, over 2,000 miles. It covers the entire state from Idaho down to Las Vegas. And so because it is fairly expansive, there's a lot of cost in terms of operations. We're not to scale yet. And so that is that remains our number one challenge, to get to scale and cover the OPEX. And that's what our goal, number one goal and objective is over the next couple of years.
But you made a fairly big bond payment the other day. I remember, or I guess it was the there was a photo with you guys with this big check. And so that, you know, they made a pun about the like physical size of the check. But that was a significant milestone, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, because we covered that debt from revenues generated from our efforts. And we had never done that previously. So, you know, that is my number one stipulation from the cities is I can't, with additional debt, I can't make it such that they have to cover that indebtedness out of their either their tax revenues or their franchise fees.
But the upside is that the network continues to thrive and it continues to grow. And it seems like from the emails and stuff that I got from different communities within Utopia, that the citizens are happy with it and they love the service. And so, you know, if I take away, you know, all that cloud that gets created by the critics, the core fundamental network and the business of providing broadband services that people want, you guys are doing that part very well.
Yeah, I think very well. I I think the system today, the network is robust. I think that we could be as courageous as saying we think it's one of the better networks in the nation, if not in the world. It's a completely redundant, fully revised system. It's carrier class. So I think in terms of what it delivers, we're delivering gig to the home symmetrically, you know, and many of our residents are receiving rates that are better than most wireless situations for 100 meg symmetrical. And of course, you got to love that. So that it is going very well. And once you have this fiber, it's just like doing drugs. You can't do without it.
People do love it.
No.
I mean, but it is basically the as the previous guest Frank said. You know, people can't do without it, and they're not going back to whatever was there before.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they got businesses to run. They've got, you know, TV habits to feed and all of that stuff. I mean, they're basically moving in a forward. They need more. And as with all things technology, you know, you always need more. And rare is the time that you actually downscale and stop needing, you know, that extra gigabit hard drive or bandwidth or what, you know, whatever the case may be.
Well, it's exactly analogous to electricity 100 years ago. We've made that point many times. I know you have, but the fact of the matter is, if you had to go back and plug your toaster in and wait for 23 minutes,
you just generator out back, you know, for the squirrels to run through there. And so let's, as a lesson sort of in business models that I think people should be aware of, and I've written about, I think, once or twice along the way, what was the business model that you inherited? What was the problem with it, as in, you know, why should people not do that again? And what did you replace it with? Because I think what you replaced it with was a very good reversal of fortune.
Well, the reason, you know, I'm with Abraham Lincoln, I think that the government shouldn't do for the people what the people can do for themselves.
Right.
I'm also very conservative, but that's why this is infrastructure.
And
so nobody else is going to do it. It's very costly. When I got there, it had been more of an approach is, since it is going to be the best thing since sliced bread, we'll put it in, everybody will just naturally flock to it. I think many networks, private or otherwise, have made those same mistakes through the dot-com era and until today.
Exactly.
You know, we think since it's the best mousetrap ever that people will naturally be inclined to sign up without even knowing how to do it. So I think that was the main problem, is that 50% of the citizenry didn't even know what Utopia was. 50% who did know, out of that 50%, of that 50% really didn't even like Utopia, but didn't know why. and so we have taken an approach that, look, it is costly infrastructure. And so if you're going to hook into it, you need to have some blood in the water. Today we do have a lease model where we do allow people to lease it. It's something that we put in place this spring. It's more traditional, but typically, you know, in Brigham City, for example, people put liens on their homes in order to bond and provide this infrastructure. And 31.5% of the citizens signed up first time through. 25% of those paid the money up front. And, you know, $3,000 isn't the actual cost of deployment, but it does obligate one to capital construction costs associated with that kind of a build. And you know, when you have that kind of an asset, you're unlikely to go switching back and forth between lowest cost providers. Not only that, Utopia being a wholesale provider, open access, then that fosters that competition anyway. And I think that's the true nature of it. So that's what we do differently today. We build only where there's demand.
Right. Now, in the survey that I'm doing currently, of economic development professionals, I gave them, I think, six possible models of how they might pay for the network. You know, everything from the traditional bond model to traditional financing to, you know, you start a foundation, or there is a community foundation that comes in and, you know, plays. And there's examples of folks that do this, right? And then I also included, you know, your model, which is you get people to pay a lump sum for their services some X number of years out, right? It's interesting that that model is of the responses I've gotten back tends to be the most favored, or maybe it's the second most favored of the people that were surveyed. Either the, you know, they said, you know, we can definitely see doing this ourselves, or, you know, we think this has a decent shot of being successful, as opposed to no one's doing bond stuff. No one even wanted to touch that one. The Community Foundation one did, got panned, which I was a little surprised by, but, you know, I figured that's, you know, subject for another day. But I found it interesting that, you know, people buy into the idea of what Utopia is doing. I mean, I didn't use Utopia as the example or as an example at all. I just said, you know, this is a potential model, right? And I look at that, and there was also a in Palo Alto, California, where some consultant came in and did a bunch of work and basically came to the conclusion that that model will not work, right? And so that became news fodder for a day.
Actually, it was their utility department that put forward, and it was really a faulty report.
Right. I've actually seen it, and I have issues with it. But that's, yeah, again, another story. But I guess my main point being is that in other communities, economic development professionals, people who work on, you know, building local economies for a living, said, you know, this could work. This whole, because I'm gathering that that was one of the things that was being criticized about you guys in this last round of you know, news stories and whatnot. So now, when you guys decided to go that route, was there any anyone else that you had to point to and say, okay, well, you know, they did this and it worked out well, or were you like one of the first community-run projects, networks, to use that model?
Yeah, there were some fringe examples, but I think we're, as we do a lot of times, pioneering that effort.
So you were out front. You were out front with this.
Yeah.
Explain that in a little more detail, because I think this is one of those models that is easy to be misinterpreted. Because the very second you say, well, people put a lien on their homes, like folks, you know, they get palpitations and whatnot because it's like, oh my God, lien, you know, because the word freaks them out. But describe like how typically this would how it works with your communities.
Well, I think you're right. The word lien is you know, a four letter word, and so it was very difficult, as you can imagine, to message that. Now people don't have to put liens on their homes. They could have paid $27.50 up front. But they could also pay $23 a month until that was paid off over a 20-year period of time. If you take that payment and all the payment for services, you are still at the same or less than you would be to pay Comcast or Quest, for example, for significantly more services. So I think at the end of the day, that was the equation that made sense. But what the initial thing was is a transferable lien. It's much like if you went and voluntarily put a second line of credit on your home or home equity line of credit to go get cabinets in your home to improve your yard, put a swimming pool or whatever else. You're upgrading your house with an asset. And in this particular case, this asset's a fiber optic line. And so when you go to sell your house, it transfers with your home like a line of credit would or something else that would need to be satisfied. And so it's a voluntary, kind of like a second line of credit. Now we've gone, because we did get a lot of flack after Brigham City for the word lien, we've gone to a contractual utility, which allows somebody to do it from a contractual standpoint with the city. But it ultimately could be fairly equivalent.
But you've also mentioned that the bigger telcos or cable companies use a similar kind of process.
Well, yeah, they lease it to you. When you look at your bill and you pay your bill, part of that bill is to cover the capital expenditure that they put in to that system. And so you're really just leasing it. It's no different other than we spell it out. Here's the cost of your capital expenditure.
Right, okay.
So I think if people really – if there was some way to truly message that, I think everybody would step forward and say, we're in. Because if that were to occur, the total net welfare – of every citizen would be significantly better. People could pay as much as $20 or $30 less a month for their telecom on average if everybody would opt in. Instead, it gets convoluted in the minutia.
Right, right.
And so, you know, we fight through that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are other models that will advance or further advance this idea, and that is to some of the things I'll speak tomorrow about when I give my presentation, but pretty much is the fact that we think of Utopia, or we think of Pennsylvania, or we think of Chattanooga, these networks as being internet, and it's internet access. But I think that is the same as 100 years ago when we think in terms of electricity as being the light bill. My grandma still refers to it as the light bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yet today, electrical infrastructure is much more than the lights. Today, on this table alone, Craig, you and I have phones, computers, everything else. Mm-hmm. That is electrical infrastructure, not just these lights.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the infrastructure that we're putting in place today is much more than just internet access.
Mm-hmm.
It's peering between communities, peering between first responders, city SCADA systems, those kinds of things that won't even access the internet. And in fact, those revenue streams and those applications are what is going to drive the ability to promote, provide, and allow for ubiquity.
Mm-hmm. So one of the themes that has gone through several of the interviews that I've done just yesterday and today has been this idea of, you know, broadband is often talked about and marketed as a service. It's marketed as an internet access service. However, if you change and step away from it and say, no, actually what you want to do is build an asset, when people look at it as an asset, it becomes almost magical, because then people look at it very differently. They look at it as something that you are capable of doing something with, something that you're capable of building onto. You know, it's sort of like it's no longer the light. If we use your example, it's no longer the light. It is the system of electricity from which a bazillion things, all powerful and good, mostly, many times, flow from. But it is, and it's not just a semantic game. It's not just a marketing game, but it is really something different when it becomes an asset.
See, when you articulate it like that, Craig, and I wish I could have articulated it like that. I might use it tomorrow in my.
Go ahead.
But I think that is truly that at its very essence, the battle is to educate what you've just articulated, because it is not semantics. It's exactly like the extensions we have in our walls, the other things, you know, the electrical motors, the microwaves, the TVs, those types of applications have driven electrical infrastructure forward because it was an asset. And we think in terms, 10 years ago, internet connectivity was kind of a service where you received emails addressing and those kinds of, today, really the services are online, you know, Yahoo, Google, you know, ESPN.net, Vonage, whatever. Those services are found online. It really is just a platform. And what we'll be seeing is a lot of platforms that are not just internet-based that become, as you said, an asset. It's what I think is missing in the puzzle from our paradigm shift here is that we've got to get to the point where like-minded entities such as Utopia, Chattanooga, Lafayette, Pennsylvania, start peering with one another on a different vein than just internet and produce what we would call ENIs, or Ethernet Network Interfaces, that allow revenue sharing to occur for peering platforms that are much more cloud-based related or peer-to-peer type related.
Mm-hmm.
Because we keep waiting for this chicken or egg phenomenon to occur. You know, how do we get the networks in place? Well, some would say, let's put forward the killer apps. But the problem with killer apps is that even though those killer apps could do some amazing stuff, they don't have a platform in which to reside, because they can't reside on shared access that the incumbents provide today because they either ratchet down the bandwidth or it's not consistent enough to deliver millisecond sensory applications. So, in effect, what we need to do is provide an addressable market of 1 million to 2 million consumers to allow greedy entrepreneurs, if you will, to market their wares over top of a broad-based platform. And the motivation for entities like ours is to do kind of a revenue sharing Ethernet network interface based system. And when we treat it, then again, as you articulated, as an asset in such a way, then we get both the chicken and the egg occurring at one time. And that's the tipping point right now that we need to get to.
Because I had a discussion yesterday with Carol Wilson, who's one of the editors at Light Reading. And when I explained to her, because she was asking me about, you know, different models. She asked me about the survey, and I was kind of going, saying, okay, well, this is, you know, these are how these models are being perceived by economic development folks. And when I explained to her about, you know, the idea of getting people paid lump sum for the service, she goes, well, that's kind of like building a new add-on to your house. It's not that you're buying the access. You're actually buying the infrastructure to be built to your door so that when you come to sell that house or condo or whatever, that you can sell it for a little bit more money because the house comes with, the digital two-car garage, I mean, in essence. So all of a sudden now the investment isn't looked at as, you know, oh my God, it's like $3,000. I know I have to like sign a lease or a lien or whatever. It's, well, no, I'm basically upgrading my house. It'd be the same as I'm modernizing the bathroom or the kitchen by bringing in this infrastructure. And then all of a sudden, you know, she and I go off into this whole tangent about, you know, broadband as asset once again, or in this case, broadband enhancing the asset that you own.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I, you know, again, you articulate it very well, but if we, I think that the tipping point comes, Craig, when we start talking about this as an asset to the community. If you were to be able to deploy this ubiquitously to any community and able to provide it as an asset for both AMI, you know, automatic information,
metering information, right.
As 911 systems, as emergency broadcast systems, as you know, helping first responders and skids. And if you're able to put that in place ubiquitously throughout a community and have it be an asset to the community, then allow people to connect into it, to their asset. The cost of their internet, for example, you could get 100 meg for $29 to $35 a month.
Then you'd be, you know, coming close to the, you know, the Korea, Sweden, and all the other places we talk about where the service is much better for less money.
But see, I just don't think, Craig, most of us really believe when we preach, is this infrastructure yet? Because we get people out there, well, I can, gosh, you know, my internet's fast, and if I can download Netflix, it only buffers once in a while, you know, I can get online YouTube, it's fast enough. And what we're not understanding is that it's not just about turning on your lights. It's about a whole new quality of life opportunity, economic development, you know, the way we can protect our citizens, so much more, and we're just not seeing that. But if we wanted to take the light bill alone as an example and we were to deploy it ubiquitously in an area, there are models that I have available to me and that we have worked with at Utopia that would show that a ubiquitously deployed system, the net welfare of every citizen is significantly better. So, for example, if I charged you $6 to $6.80 a month to do your automatic metering, your first responder, 911, or whatever the case might be, say I even charged you $10 a month. That's a lot of money for many folks, $120 a year. You know? But what if I could drop your bills for other things, you know, $20 to $25 a month?
Right.
Your net welfare being $10 to $15 better by being all in. We just don't treat this like infrastructure yet, and when we do, we'll be successful.
But is there a danger by having the discussion be, okay, well, we should treat this as infrastructure, makes it easier for someone to say, well, internet is only getting YouTube, so why am I spending tax dollars so some kid can surf YouTube all day? Because, I mean, and what I'm saying is that I think that, you know, a lot of people default to what is easy or what is known. So if you say, well, it's like the utility, there very well may be a lot of people who still think, like your mom or your grandma, that it's about the light bill and it's only the light. And so we talk about, you know, broadband as a utility. Oh, right, broadband is what I use to get to Facebook, right? Because everyone defaults to the simple thing they know. Whereas if you, which again has been kind of the recurring theme during these interviews, if I talk about it as an asset, do I the discussion of broadband even more good than trying to explain it to people as a utility? So in other words, if you went to people in whatever your next city is going to be that may join Utopia and say, you know, well, consider this, you know, utility like gas, electric, water. We're just adding a fourth utility. Or you said, well, we're going to sell you this asset that is going to make the value of your main asset, your home, worth more. it's going to make the value of your kids' education worth more, because your kids can now tap into, you know, study abroad programs and heaven knows where, right? In essence, you turn your marketing campaign, if you will, into a discussion of the asset as an asset alone, or an asset that improves your other assets.
No, I think you are accurate. I think if we approach it the way, you know, you perceived my comments to be, I think mm-hmm. that we will fail. I don't think people will see it that way, nor will they see it in the right light. So I guess what I'm suggesting is beyond that even.
Okay.
I think the cities, municipalities, governments should use these networks as a means to be more efficient in both first responding
mm-hmm.
and in their utilities, as SCADA. They should put these systems in place to do other things.
Right.
Now, the effect of having done that is a ubiquitous deployment that allows someone to say, and by the way, one of the applications of our asset that we put in the ground
mm-hmm,
is quick
mm-hmm.
internet access.
Right.
And if you want to use that application, it's $30.
Right.
And somebody may say, well, then what do I need to simply plug in?
Mm-hmm.
It's $30. We plug in like we did in our hotel today. You know, it's $12.95 for a day. Right? But if you plug in, it's $30 for the month
mm-hmm.
and have as much as you want.
And, right.
And so I think that we're approaching it again incorrectly, in that we're putting it in as an asset to internet connectivity. I think we change our whole paradigm shift.
Right.
And say, communities to look at this as a way to make their cities better, more efficient,
right.
et cetera. And one of the significant applications that they can sell is connectivity
mm-hmm.
to the World Wide Web
mm-hmm.
that helps them recoup much of the cost. And I think in addition, there will be other applications. I think we're working right now with the University of Idaho and other telephone companies in Idaho to produce an extended platform that will
mm-hmm.
be kind of a Linux-based system that will allow anybody to write applications to what we call an extended platform off the access
mm-hmm.
form.
Mm-hmm.
By doing that, we can work peer-to-peer with those such groups. But you know, it would be something that you could come home and sensory information could be water in your yard, measuring the fall of geriatrics patients,
mm-hmm.
EKGs,
mm-hmm.
Could reduce the digital divide. And also marketing, you know, type of brokered marketing in homes.
Mm-hmm.
But all those applications are revenue streams to cities based off the, as you put it, Craig, the asset.
Right. And I started my world of business as a marketing person. This is sort of, you know, kind of how I got to here. It's been a long route. But, you know, but the short and long of it was, you know, I started by helping people with technology products, explain where they have value, because invariably the people who own the technology, the same way I think the people who promote, call it internet access as a technology, if you will, get enamored with the technology. They get enamored with the speed. They get enamored with things that are technically true, but they seem to miss the fact that that's not what people are buying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that if you look at many of the political battles, you know, Frank, the guest before, you know, has survived some tremendous political battles, and part of it, I think, part of what gets them into that position is, you know, people can't understand what exactly that we're talking about, you know, and so it's like, why are we having this political battle to discuss internet access? I mean, like, why am I going to expend political capital to fight my state legislature later, or, you know, the whole body, to get easier access for some kids to roam through YouTube? And, you know, whereas, I also asked Frank this question. I said, well, look, if you got the business community to step up as a body and say, oh, no, this isn't about internet access. This is about, you know, our ability to be competitive in 25 different countries. It sort of takes a lot of the, you know, the sting out of it. I think the other thing, you can tell me if this is true or not, because you come from a red state, you are conservative. I see when it gets explained properly at the local level, broadband stops being a partisan issue. It even stops being a large business versus small. It becomes just basically a sort of a across-the-board local issue, right? Because people see it very differently.
Yeah, I think education and this effort properly understood that there becomes no red and blue. It's all big old purple effort.
And
I see that. I think democratically, Republican, if you really understand what it is we're trying to put forward, it is not a building roads. It's just building airports. And we all want a better quality of life, and
right.
we want to be competitive. We want our communities to have economic development, all these things you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're properly understood. It is not a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it is politicized.
Right. It is that. So let's talk about, you know, some advice. We're going to put you in peer counseling mode,
okay.
right? I'm a community. I'm looking out there. I say, well, do I want to take this challenge? And maybe for them, they may say, well, I could form a nonprofit. I could form a public-private partnership. So assume that they won't necessarily look at it as, do I want to be a government-run network, more that I want to be a community-run network. How do you know? Like, what are the top two things to help them get support locally? And then we can talk about the other elements of building a network from there. But let's just start with the, you know, you got this idea. How do they get support? What's the way to cross that chasm of knowledge?
Well, I do think that there are certain core principles in life, not to get so esoteric or conceptual, but I think. There are core principles. I think the number one thing is what is the core objective of this network?
Mm-hmm.
Is it to drive down the cost of the monopoly or the duopoly that exists in an area? And that stranglehold, is it because you just don't have anything at all? Or is it because you recognize that you need this type of open infrastructure, this type of capability that's just not going to be forthcoming to stay competitive? What is it that is your objective, I think, is the number one thing to look at. I think some of the cities of utopia have made that error or in the past as that paradigm has shifted several times.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I think we're facing some of those same questions. You know, what is it that we are?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that we're trying to become?
Right.
Are we truly infrastructure, like we say?
Mm-hmm.
Are we trying just to get to a break-even standpoint, like we say? I think we're trying to answer some of those same questions today. So I think communities need to understand, number one, do they have the support politically to look at it as infrastructure? And if they do, there's a different approach.
Right.
If they want to do it to drive the duopoly to be more competitive, then there's a different approach.
Right.
You know, do we want to get schools and our anchor institutions up to speed with better connectivity and be more competitive in our business market, then there's a different approach. And I think there's a number of like-minded entities throughout the United States that they should visit, talk to. I think Utopia could provide an extensive amount of knowledge on what not to do, as well as some really good ideas on what might be good things to do. So I think those two suggestions, there's a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
I think also make sure you have a clear path of funding available to you. You can't get hung up on the fence in this effort. And so you really have to understand your modeling. And what you can really do, and you have to have the not only political will to go through what you're going to have to go through, but you have to have the financial ability. And there's some communities out there that I see right now that have had the political will, but not the financial capability.
Mm-hmm.
They get hamstrung, just as those that sometimes like we did. We had some financial capabilities. We did it wrong, and now we lost the political will in some cases. So, you know, you've got to have your ducks in a row.
Mm-hmm. How do you, then step two, how do you propose that people assess financial models to figure out what's best for them?
Well, I think it goes back to the number one question is, what's your objective?
True, okay.
If we're looking at a ubiquitous build in an area, then that's the other thing, Craig, is there are so many people with advice. So many consultants, so many vendors, and so somebody's going to be in there saying, go GFON, go Active Ethernet, go use our equipment, use this equipment. And I think you really got to get to those people like us and others who have dirt in their fingernails. There are great private entities, Donnie Smith from Jaguar Communications, the Nulties have done some things up in Burlington, up in
Vermont,
and you've got Lafayette, who's fought at Utopia, certainly a wealth of what not to do and to do.
Mm-hmm.
Lafayette certainly has had some advantages. I mean, Chattanooga, and that they're a power
right.
company, and they've had some good subsidies. And so I think you got to do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your objective? And that kind of answers what the financial picture is going to be.
Okay. Next question. No, or next step. How do you separate the good from the bad, the charlatans from the real, you know, knowledgeable people?
Yeah, you got to get under the covers, and you need to get, come in and meet with us at Utopia. We'd be happy to open up the, our information and things that we've done that have worked, have not worked, some of the issues we've experienced. I know that many other organizations would do the same. Places like Fiber to the Home are good places, although you're going to find charlatans here that,
mm-hmm.
Are saying, look, we've got the best way about it.
Right.
And so I think you have to get with those, again, have dirt in their fingernails and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
And find out what vendors, what equipment, how they did it, what were the mistakes made. And I wish Utopia had that advantage today.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would do it a lot different if we could have done it as in retrospect.
Mm-hmm. Next would be the political side. Not everybody obviously will live, every community is in a hostile state or a state as hostile to city ownership as, say, North Carolina and Utopia, and there's like a couple of others that are just like extremely rigid in their anti-muni network behavior. But I contend that no matter how you do this, you have to engage the political apparatus, either the city council, the mayor, maybe at some point the state legislature. How does or should a city, a community prepare for that engagement?
I don't know if you've been in a hurricane before.
I have not, but I can imagine it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I don't know, Craig. I think it does depend on where you are. It can be fierce.
Mm-hmm.
It can be unfair. It can be intentionally mischievous. And there certainly are people with – and look, the telecom industry is extremely powerful lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things that they don't necessarily want to see succeed.
Right.
It's my opinion that the telecom the incumbents could do a very – great service by working with the communities to provide these kinds of infrastructures, and I think they would succeed if they did. But
mm-hmm.
they choose to litigate and to lobby and to fight and to put lipstick on a pig.
Right.
So, you better just be ready for a hurricane.
Okay.
When it happens, and don't you're poking
mm-hmm.
A lion, a tiger, right in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
You're grabbing on his tail, poking him in the eye, and you got to be prepared for what happens next.
Okay. Next step along the process, you have to manage expectations. Some of my biggest criticisms, and in fact why I do this survey every year of economic development professionals, is that since my entry into the space in 2005, I've heard politicians, I've heard policymakers at all levels of government explain, this is why we want to do broadband. You want to make people, easier for people to look for jobs, or we want to bring, new convention business to our area. What I would find is a disconnect between the politicians and the policymakers and how they presented it versus those people who are actually in the trenches. And ultimately, it kind of comes down to managing the expectations of what's real and what's not, what's possible and what's not with broadband. But when you're in the trenches, how do you manage that part about how do you manage expectations so that you get people pumped up and totally supporting you, but at the same time, you don't oversell it, which gets you into all kinds of hot water later.
This is Utopia's one of their big issues, and it just hasn't been historic. I think I've made this mistake a couple times too. I think we have made promises that we didn't deliver on,
mm-hmm.
and so I think you're wise to bring this up. I think you do need to be realistic about your expectations, and you need to be able to deliver on what you say or over-deliver. At minimum, and Utopia didn't. Utopia, which was rightly pointed out by the legislature, said they could be done in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are, 10 years later. So,
okay.
I thought there's some things we could have done that didn't happen, and there are always our excuses. There's some excuses that I've had, and they're valid excuses.
Uh-huh.
They're valid reasons. such and such happened. But I think managing expectations is a huge part of it. It's something I haven't done as well. I'm trying to do better now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're wise to point that out. You got to do what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got to be accountable for what you do. And I think if you say, look, we're going to have 1,000 subscribers, you better make sure you hit 1,000 subscribers. Or I think more precisely, you better make the revenue numbers that you say you're going to hit.
Mm-hmm. Do you do that by creating a position on the broadband team? Do you do it by, what does the execution side of it look like in terms of, is there a person whose job is managing expectations? I mean, how does it get implemented?
Yeah, but the problem is that most of these efforts are entrepreneurial. They're not well established. I think that at some point we would do well for all of us to combine some of our efforts. I keep trying to talk to people and say, let's combine efforts.
Right.
But I think you do need to have, in my case, I'm where the buck stops. And
mm-hmm.
so I have to be accountable for that reporting and for what occurs. But it is a huge thing. And in my case, there's 16 cities, 16 mayors.
Mm-hmm.
I meet with just even in my own active cities right now, there's well over 60 public elected officials, city management, more
mm-hmm.
that I have to meet. And that is such a difficult process,
mm-hmm.
and especially where it is so entrepreneurial anyway. You're on the bleeding edge, even if you've got all your ducks in a row.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is, it's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to manage those expectations like you put before is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. So in a similar vein, when you have, or especially when you have several jurisdictions, 15, 16 cities where they are, they have their own interests, they have their own governments, they have, a lot of their own way that they do things that they do. How do you keep those cats in the same herd and moving in generally the same direction?
I think it is butterflies or cats, and sometimes I'm not sure I do it really well. We do try.
Mm-hmm.
I meet with most of the cities on a weekly basis, representatives
mm-hmm.
from the cities. I meet with them on a monthly board meetings. I try to provide outward education, but this is such a complex and sophisticated effort that unless you're engaged all the time, you just don't understand it
mm-hmm.
as well. And so I don't know. I continue to look for ways to message stronger, better, more
mm-hmm.
accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a challenge for me. I've been at it now for 4 years. You'd think I'd learn better. I still struggle with getting everybody under the same roof, of both in terms of their education,
mm-hmm.
In terms of what they should do. And people have their opinions, and they're as diverse as the people themselves. And so I don't know. I don't know. I'd ask you, how would you do it?
Well, I think that number one, it's correct to say that no one's going to have a good, flawless method of doing it because it is very open. I mean, it has been an open process since I've been involved, and that's been since 2005. So I don't think any of that is going to change. What seems like, if I kind of look at what other communities have done, they're doing multiple projects, is you have to create some mechanism, some communication mechanism. I think that the takeaway from every conversation I've ever had has been, a group has to figure out a communication structure. It can be emails, newsletters, a space on the internet, a blog. Guys I interviewed from North Carolina, Wilson, North Carolina, talked about the blog was actually the best thing they did to keep people on the same page because it was constantly updated, it was constantly added to, but mainly it was central and everybody could participate in it. And I think that, you're really looking at doing something similar if you've got, in your role, because that doesn't necessarily say that you're going to have this very specific structure. It just basically says you've got to commit to having a communication vehicle.
Yeah, and I think part of the thing that convolutes a bit more for us is that we are an open access
mm-hmm.
system, and so we have 20 private companies service providers, that we have to protect the information.
Mm-hmm.
Truly a government entity that can be fully disclosing on a blog or out there in the public.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because, in effect, we also have to protect competitive information. You know, I'll give you an example, Greg. We have right now stimulus lines going in certain places, and those stimulus lines, as they go in, the first thing the incumbents do is they say, hey, that's where Utopia is going, and so they go in with these low cutthroat competitive pricing and try to take us out of the market.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of information we can't put out there.
Right. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. I think it's also a very good way to finish the day, because, you know, we've talked about, you know, a lot of the, you know, folks who have had struggles, but it's been fairly smooth sailing. You guys seem to have had a lot of strong wins because of the politics of it. I mean, not really, to me, a lot of it isn't management, it's politics, but I think it's good for people in communities to understand this side of the discussion, why it's so important to manage expectations and why it's so good to have strong communication. So for those insights, you know, as it's great, and I appreciate the fact that you were on board today.
Thanks, Craig, for having us, and anybody who would be go ahead and give me a call.
Excellent. And that's our show for today. We're back tomorrow. Thank you, everyone, for being in our audience today. Have a great day.